Today and choose a McDouble, McChicken, or large sweet tea, all just a dollar each. The dollar menu, only available at McDonald's. I'm loving it. The Riff, Riff, Riff.
To WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Peter and Jalene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jalene.
Thank you very much, and welcome. Welcome to the broadcast. Hi, Jalene.
Peter, hello.
Should we go through the litany of good holiday wishes? There's someone here. I hope he's not listening. When you say to him, happy holiday, he says, it's Christmas.
I know.
Well, it's also the pagan holiday of Yule. You know,
right.
That lot of
the
Christmas stuff. Yeah, the Christmas stuff was adopted and adapted by early Christianity. The Yule log and the Yuletide and all that.
The tree.
And the tree, right. And so, but Merry Christmas and Happy Kwanzaa and Happy Hanukkah.
Yeah.
And are we missing anybody?
What
about all those people that don't believe in anything?
There's an African American.
The Kwanzaa.
Kwanzaa, right.
Right. On the first day of Kwanzaa, that's something else, isn't it? But they get a lot of days in there. I mean, I like that, you know, because, so I could really go for Hanukkah and Kwanzaa because you get a lot of days off. You know, here we just get one for Christmas, right? Yeah. So, hey, welcome to the broadcast. I'm debating what to introduce here. I mean, what's really inflaming the nation is this whole thing about gun control.
Yeah.
The president of the National Rifle Association, the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, who many people have now called the craziest man in America.
And he said, call me crazy.
Yeah, well,
he doesn't care.
He's crazy. But he's really not. He's actually, he's made millions of dollars off of the fear that motivates a lot of people to buy weapons. And
that's just plain evil.
Essentially, that's what the NRA is. It's a lobbying group for the major gun manufacturers who are also the major supporter of the NRA. And the NRA, in turn, is one of the major supporters of the Republican Party.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So all the far right-wing policies that the Republican Party got shoved up their butt in the last election, what do we call the White Christian Nationalist Party that got their socks handed to them and a bunch of other articles
like
of clothing.
Evangelical.
Yeah.
That?
So that's what the NRA is. And so when you back them, you're essentially backing lobbyists, gun manufacturers, and the Republican Party.
And they spent so much money, over $13 million the NRA spent in a failed attempt to defeat President Obama. And they spent millions on that and to win these 8 Senate races, but their candidates lost all but one Senate race. So, sorry, there goes your money down the drain.
Yeah, they didn't do well. Oh, hey, we would invite you to call in to 313-298-WRIF and give your opinion.
Yes, 313-298-9743.
And, yeah, I was thinking. Of course, maybe he was reading, too. I was listening to Screaming Scott, one of our DJs here at WRIF, and he, because this is also the contest line when, you know, the riff is rocking. And so he said that, 313-298-WRIF. And I was wondering, what he probably doesn't have this mental block the way I do, but I can, after all these years,
been here a lot I can longer. Do it.
313, I had to look, 298-9743.
That's it. Well, you're never going to get
kinda,
it. Just
I kind of cheated. Yeah. If you'd like to email us, by the way, you can do that very easily. It's at calltalkyes, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If they're short, we may read them. We don't read them all, but many we do. And you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. And a lot of likes. We'd like you to like us.
Join in the fun.
Yeah, there's always good
heavy stuff. It's not necessarily
there's
fun.
Always. But what's our favorite thing on there? Let me go to it right now. What's our favorite thing on there right now? Oh yeah,
Ted,
the Motor City goofball. Talk about angry white men. He's right at the leading the pack, and old Ted Nugent. He has been, I can't say that
word.
Canceled.
He had a couple of shows that were going to be on one of the cable networks.
Well, they weren't both his, but the Discovery Channel has canceled two gun-toting so-called reality shows, American Guns and Ted Nugent's Gun Country, featuring the formerly musical, now creepy, welfare-hating right-winger, it says here, at commondreams.org. He says, nobody has more absolute fun with guns than my family. Like millions of American families, these utilitarian tools and works of art serve us well in all manner of good, clean, legal, safe, fun recreation and competition. Our American dream is measured in ballistic.
Then why are the numbers so outrageous? This when it is comes to gun violence. In
this is
country?
One sick puppy.
He's out of his mind.
Yeah. I mean, like we always say, people use guns for hunting. They have a sense they may need them for home protection.
Yeah.
They collect them. They do. And some people, there are works of art. But, you know, there's the utilitarian value. That's a little hard to really make an argument for. Well, if you have a gun in a house, I was just reading these statistics, you have 42 times more likely to shoot your spouse, a family member, or yourself than an intruder.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, what was that guy's name? Adam Lanza, right? This shooter at the school last week. Didn't do his mom very good, did it? Yeah, didn't work out very well for a home defense for her.
No,
yeah.
No.
But I think by now we've heard that all these guns are just flying off the shelf, all the ammunition is gone. So everybody that wants one probably has one. So even if they decide belatedly that they're going to have like a semi-automatic weapon ban or deal with the ammunition or ban things like bulletproof vests, I mean, why in the world would any civilian want a bulletproof vest?
Did you see the thing about backpacks? There's some
bulletproof backpacks. You know how much they are? Like $400.
Wow.
I mean, people are so freaked that I was reading this article, and parents were saying, I don't care how much it costs. I want to make sure that my kid is safe. Well,
and, you know, I get that, but that's so sad that that's the way it is, that it has to be that way.
And the fear that parents have, because as we know, I mean, think about you and I who are each childless. I mean, when I say Jalene and I are childless, it's not like for lack of trying or no. Does that sound right? No.
We have no children.
Yeah, we have no children. Neither of us have any children because we're not married or a couple or anything like that. We're
together, you mean?
Yeah.
No,
we don't have any children separately either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But how this latest mass murder affected us, like it affected everyone, but the parents of people, particularly people that have had children, even, you know, they have an adult children now, or people now that have small children, because every one of them can put themselves in the place of those parents. Was it Sandy Hook? Ooh. I don't even have it in front of me. Sandy Hook, yeah. And so I could imagine people saying, I want to get my kid a bulletproof backpack.
Ugh.
I mean, you know.
That's just hard to even grasp.
So in terms of Ted, who is really just, I mean, why can't he just shut up and play his guitar?
Go hunt. Go do what you got to do, man.
Yeah. But and, yeah, please. He talks about it as a utilitarian item. Well, it does have utility. Like here. And if this was any other industrialized, developed country in the world, all of what I'm going to read you now, just real quickly, would be on the front page of every newspaper and in the first lead in a newscast. Like if it happened in Windsor, if it happened in London, England, or Paris, or something like that. A gunman fatally shot three people on Friday morning, including a woman who was hanging Christmas decorations inside a church during a bloody rampage that spread terror along a stretch of a two-lane country road in central Pennsylvania. The gunman was shot and killed by state troopers after he opened fire at officers and rammed his pickup truck into a patrol car. In Longmont, Colorado, investigators were unable to immediately determine when a shooter purchased the gun used to kill three people, including his ex-girlfriend, who was on the phone with a 9/11 dispatcher when she was killed. The gunman, who had just been released from jail on domestic violence charges, then shot and killed himself on Tuesday. Again, this would be, I would be willing to bet, 98% of you never even heard of it.
Heard that one, right.
I mean, it's ordinary. It's just commonplace. United States, we're always talking about we can't figure what positive thing the United States is number one in. Remember, people used to say, number one, number one. Well, we have more guns per person than any other country in the world. So we're number one. But Yemen is close at our heels, folks. So
really?
Go get that gun before that Muslim commie in the White House makes them illegal. Authorities say a man in Topeka, Kansas, suspecting the fatal shooting of two Topeka police officers, has died after an armed standoff with law enforcement at a house in the city. It goes on and on and on like that. So, but, you know, there's so much else going on that that is important. And one of the things that guns have done, I mean, it's an extraordinarily important topic, but I suspect that they probably will pass some sort of law limiting the purchase of assault rifles and the type of ammunition and the type of magazines, and that they'll have more background checks. And imagine that the NRA doesn't want any of this. What they want is an armed guard in every single 100,000 schools in America. I mean, about 23,000 of them already have it. It's not the oddest thing in the world to have it.
Yeah.
But when you think of armed guards in a school, you think of schools that are in high crime areas that have gang shootings and what have you. And now, so this is what all of the United States has become. So what we really have to look at, whether you think that's a good thing to have or a bad thing to have, I mean, most authorities think it's an awful thing to have, but even if you think it's a good thing to have, I think that's really beside the question. I think we've got to really look at what have we become. And this Wayne LaPierre character, this million-dollar lobbyist that's made a fortune off of your many of your fears. Like I say, some people just want it for target shooting, hunting, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's happened is that the NRA is one of the forces in this society that makes people not much more fearful, makes them fearful. I mean, there's not a real need to be fearful in this country, even with what's going on. I mean, I talk to people that are talking about they're afraid to go to a shopping mall now.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Because who knows when Mr. Crazy is going to take his AR-15 and, you know, because some real or imagined slight and start opening up. And I suspect there probably will be an increase in all of this because, as we said last week, this is becomes a public statement. For people filled with rage and madness.
This martyrdom.
The ultimate statement that they can make.
Right.
Because, gee, you know, everybody's horrified. They're thinking, that's good.
It's just awful. And the fact that they're even talking about gun legislation in Washington at this point, I think they should have been talking about this a long time ago.
You know, there was...
I took this one incident. I know it's a huge one, but this kind of thing happens, you know, not to that extent, but... Mass murders happen every week.
Yeah. There's a video online. I should have put that on our Facebook page where they have, they have Bill Clinton, George Bush, and Barack Obama. saying almost the identical words after these mass shootings, after Columbine and Virginia Tech.
Their speeches.
And now, I don't know why
the latest
people,
one that happened.
Yes.
Sandy Hook,
yeah. And, I mean, it's incredible. It's the words are almost identical. And then nothing is done. But I guess I don't think much is going to change if they did everything that the gun control people wanted. I mean, I certainly think they should do it. Because I don't think any, where's the harm here? I mean, the real fringy elements are thinking, well, we're not going to be able to defend themselves against the jackbooted stormtroopers.
Well, it's like, how much do you need? And come on, you know, there's paranoia and there's paranoia.
Yeah. 538, pardon me, is Nate Silver's political calculus column in the New York Times. He's the guy that called
Obama for president.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody else was saying, you know, yeah, Romney's right there. He said, no, he doesn't have a chance.
Yeah.
I figured at the end, he said he had a 7% chance. Romney had a 7% chance of becoming president.
But then did you see that
his son?
Tug or whatever it is. What the hell's with these names?
Is he connected with Sarah Palin?
I know. I thought, did they get together on that one? He said his dad did not want to be president.
Yeah. Well, self-fulfilling prophecy.
I guess,
prophecy, yeah.
He got what he wanted then.
So he says, party identity in a gun cabinet. An American child grows up in a married household in the suburbs. What are the chances that his family keeps a gun in their home? The probability is considerably higher than residents of New York and other big cities might expect. About 40% of married households reported having a gun in their home, according to an exit poll from the 2008 election. That's because they didn't ask the question in 2012.
Oh, okay.
If they identify as Democratic voters, the chances are only 1 in 4 or 25% that they have a gun in the house. But chances are more than twice that, almost 60% if they're Republicans. In 1973, about 55% of Republicans reported having a gun in their household against 45% of Democrats. Gun ownership has actually declined over the last 40 years. Man, that's...
That doesn't seem possible.
No, but, well, people are buying them by the thousands, and there's millions of guns, so maybe... But the gun ownership rate among adults that identified as Democrats has fallen to 22%, and it remained at about 50% among Republican adults. So what is up with that?
Yeah.
In urban areas, 40% of Republican voters said they had a gun in their home, while 20% of Democrats did.
We're a bunch of tree huggers. I mean, come on.
Well, I wonder if people think that's what it is. 313-298-WRIF.
You know? Everything else.
58% in suburban areas. 58% of Republican voters said there was a gun in their household against just 27% of Democrats.
Very interesting.
And I don't know, you know, you could look at it lots of different ways. I mean, you could say they're sensible. But I don't know. You live in the suburbs. I mean, white people often move to the suburbs to flee what they thought was or perceived as black crime. Right?
Yes.
Particularly during that great migration to the suburbs during the 60s and 70s when there was a lot of crime. So they live out there in these lily white suburbs.
Yeah.
The crime rate hovers around zero, and they've got all these armaments. I don't get it.
It's actually kind of laughable.
Yeah, right. So,
in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so. let me see. I got the. People like the Tea Party. You see, the North Carolina Tea Party, right after the post-Newtown massacre, had a great gun giveaway. That's what they call it, the great gun giveaway. They're raffling off two guns, an AR-15 assault rifle, and a .22 caliber Magnum handgun.
I could not believe this when I read this.
These are...
After this Newtown massacre, this is what they do? Raffle off guns? These people are sick in the head. They really are, Peter.
Right. No, they are. It's
you could win a let's see, what is it? A .223 caliber AR-15 assault rifle, and the other one was a .22 Magnum pistol.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we missed, Jalene and I were off a couple of weeks ago. And what happened then was this lame duck. I wonder if people really realize what that means.
Yeah.
That means that once elections have occurred, like in November, the legislators that remain until the start of the next legislative session are called lame duck. I mean, because they can't really fly and all that. So the Republicans have shot through all this election, aimed at all their little pet projects like restricting a woman's right to choose and stuff. They carried guns in churches and
schools. And schools.
Which Snyder actually vetoed.
He did veto that.
Yeah. And
that was a smart move.
And the worst, of course, was the so-called right to work law, which we did talk about, which in other words is not really a right to work, but actually is another
a right to get paid less if you're a union member.
Yeah, right.
And I know that his ratings have, you know, we don't pay a ton of attention to that, but his ratings have gone down since he made that decision.
Yeah, Snyder's ratings. So this right to work, the Republicans, I remember, didn't we put this forth? The Republicans were saying they wanted to protect workers. They wanted to give workers more rights. I was just wondering whether there's anybody in the single person in the audience that actually believes that the Republican Party was motivated by giving union members or people in union shops more freedom.
Yeah, whatever.
And I will go over quickly that they do have more freedom. They have the freedom to freeload. They have the freedom to mooch, to use these right-wing terms. If you're in a shop...
And who are they?
The people that aren't paying union dues.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have a union. You have a union shop, and say a third of the people say, we're not paying dues. And so then they can't have any dues taken out of their money, out of their wages.
Mm-hmm.
But they still get represented by the union. They still get the grievance procedure. They still get bargained for. They still get the rights, the benefits, the pensions,
it's
everything.
Bad thing.
Yeah, right.
Wherever it exists, it has taken things to a new low.
And actually, it's part of the race to the bottom. I mean, when you eliminate unions as this is the main, who knows if the Republican Party even has a strategy anymore. They got whooped so badly on both in the presidency and the Senate, and they got whooped in the House.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. They got whooped in the House. You say, wait a minute, don't they have a majority? Well, I'll talk about that in a minute, but they got whooped in the House. But here, from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, wages for both union and non-union workers are lower in states with right-to-work laws than in those without. Now, this isn't just about, these people say, well, union janitors, they're making $94 an hour or whatever. And I'm only making $9, so I hate unions, as opposed to thinking, gee, why don't we have a union at our place? But anyway, it affects everyone. Both union and non-union workers have lower wages and benefits in those states that have right to work laws. So are we gonna join them? The provision of both employer-sponsored health insurance and employer-sponsored pensions is also lower in right to work laws. So you get less benefits.
Yep.
And it goes on and on and on here that every, the health insurance, the pensions, the, just trying to skim this. But, it really was intended to drive down wages, which is another goal of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, well, we're going to attract more jobs because they don't have to, new companies coming in won't have to deal with living wages.
Right. Let's not have a good quality of life for the people who are doing the work for you.
That's right. Yeah. So let me just get to this. Let me see. What has,
What?
Oh, I just had a caller who waited on hold to tell me, F. Obama. Oh, you're so nutty.
Well, that is just so original, well thought out. Excellent.
Okay.
Excellent.
I got to take a personal call on the air. Can I do that?
For real?
Yeah. Okay.
Depends on how personal.
Hey, Natasha, you're on the air.
I'm Mr. Orby. Merry Christmas.
Okay. Natasha, don't tell him where. You can't tell them where, Natasha, because then we'll have all my fans assembling in there. This is after we play handball. We go to this restaurant, and then Natasha is this great waitress.
Hi, Natasha.
Hi, nice to meet you.
You too.
Are we going to have a big fancy dinner next Tuesday? Next Wednesday, really.
Wednesday, yeah.
All right. So you're supposed to email me so I can set it up.
I know. I'm talking to Jeff tomorrow about it. I think he talked to... I think he contacted one of you guys that came in on Friday. Saba told me a couple of you guys came in. I don't know which one of you.
All right, wasn't me. But Natasha, we'll talk on Wednesday, all right?
All right, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too.
All right, you're a social butterfly, yes. Peter.
All right. Are we on the air? Oh, yeah, we are. let's see. Okay, back to business now. All right, so how did the Republicans' party get handed their lunch, their socks, I've been saying, their shorts, because we know that they got whooped badly in the presidential election.
Yep.
They lost badly in the Senate. But you say, wait a minute, they got this pretty big edge. Okay, I don't have the figures in the House right in front of me. But, you know, the Democrats got the majority of House votes in the country. They got a few million more than the Republicans. So say, wait a minute, what's going on here? Do you know the phrase gerrymandering? Some of you do. What that means is you carve out these districts, and Republicans, because they controlled the state legislatures, they were able to create the districts that favored.
It happened here in Michigan.
It happened here in Michigan, big time, yeah. But here, this is from a week ago or so. From the New York Times. Pardon me. Wisconsinites leaned Democratic when they went to the polls last month, voting to reelect President Obama, choosing Tammy Baldwin to be their new United States Senator. First, I think, openly lesbian senator if I'm thinking of the right one, I hope it is, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, it's not like it's an insult, right?
No, that's right, yeah, Peter.
That's right. But, and casting more total votes for Democrats than Republicans in races for Congress and the state legislature. But thanks in part to the way the Republicans drew the new congressional and state legislative districts for this year's elections, Republicans will still outnumber Democrats in Wisconsin's new congressional delegation 5-3 and control both houses of the legislature. Ooh. What about
what
this
happened?
Democracy thing, right? Pennsylvanians also voted to reelect Mr. Obama, elected Democrats to several statewide offices, and cast about 83,000 more votes for Democratic congressional candidates than for Republicans. But new maps drawn by Republicans, including for the 7th District outside Philadelphia, a Rorschach test inkblot of a district snaking through five counties that helped this one guy get elected, mm-hmm. The Republicans now will have a 13-5 majority in the congressional delegation from Pennsylvania. So you got this? I mean, the Republican Party is this racket, folks. I mean, it doesn't even deserve to be called a political party. It's just a racket that supports the racket of big finance and big industrialists and big business in general. Let's see. Republican drawn lines also help Republicans win lopsided majorities in other swing states that Mr. Obama won. Democratic congressional candidates won nearly half the votes in Virginia, but only 27% of its seats. And 48% of the vote in Ohio, but only a quarter of the seats. So where does it matter? Well, how about in Michigan? That Mr. Obama, as they always call people by these Mr.
In the New York Times.
Yeah,
right.
New York
Everyone.
Times. Redistricting may sound esoteric, but it can have an impact on governing at the state and federal levels. It may have played a role in Michigan's decision to pass anti-union legislation this week, a month after Mr. Obama won the state by 9 points. I mean, you get that? This was one of the biggest victories for Obama in the Midwest. Michigan Republicans drew the maps in the last two cycles, and even though Republicans lost some seats last month, they were able to keep their majority with 54% of the seats in the state's House of Representatives while getting just 45% of the popular vote. So when you hear the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, talking about, should we explain that every time?
Well, his name's Boehner, but it's...
It's not Boehner, it's Boehner.
E. When the
two vowels go walking, the first one does the talking.
B-O-E.
Yeah. And also the...
so childish.
The harmonica. The harmonica. It's not a Boehner harmonica.
It's a Hainer.
A Hainer harmonica. It's a Hohner. Yeah. And actually, my sister-in-law, who speaks fluent German, someone, a German speaker, give it to us the way it's supposed, but it's like, you know, then
right.
It's got an ech in there. All right, good. So we're getting screwed, people. This is not democracy. All right, I want to introduce one thing, and then we're going to take a break and invite you to call at 313-298-WRIF. Now, you know Frankenmuth, where the all the chicken,
Christmas.
All the, it's Christmas 365
it
days
is.
A year. I can't imagine a town I would go to. I don't know. There's a town in Quebec called Asbestos. And in the middle of the town, they have towering piles of asbestos tailings.
No, they don't.
They do. They do. Can I get a witness? Anybody ever
Why?
Been there? Well, because they mine it there. I don't know if they still mine, but it's maybe left over. Anyway,
God.
I would go to Asbestos, Quebec before I would go to Frankenmuth. Without a doubt. But it says, driving into this tourist mecca, one side of the road is lined with dozens of life-size Christmas displays, carolers, toy soldiers, and nativity scenes that pass in a rush of colors, twinkling lights, and sometimes moving parts. What does that mean?
Probably like little mechanized snowmen and stuff.
But then it's as easy to miss. Easy to miss is a lone object on the other side of the road, a white 55-foot cross. Yeah, like I can be walking down the street and someone say, hey, did you see that white 55?
No!
What? No, where?
I didn't see it anywhere.
Where? Yeah. A Washington group, which is Americans United for Separation of Church and State, says they want the cross removed because it sits in a city park. And but everybody in Frankenmuth, because their Christmas thing is their bread and butter, right?
Well, yeah.
So everybody, the business and the churches and a lot of the people, they want to defend the 36-year-old cross. The Frankenmuth City Council has dared Americans United to file a lawsuit.
They're so, like, okay.
So the head of the group, all right, man.
Yeah, let's go.
Let's go. Yeah. They plan to file a legal challenge within several months. It received a complaint about the cross in 2008, but they were busy with other skirmishes. By the time the resident who made the complaint had moved out of town and no longer wants any part of the legal challenge, he's 70 years old. He's an atheist who lives in Bridgeport Township, and he's still smarting from the way he was treated by residents. Talk radio called him an idiot. A blogger told him to pull in his horns. Children taunted him in the street. Man, this guy must have thin skin.
Children taunted him. No.
I can't believe it. Why is this guy an idiot? I could say that, you know, we don't believe in the separation of church and state. We think that that it's okay to have religion in the public square, even though it's expressly...
This is not what we're saying.
Yeah, it's expressly forbidden in the Constitution and all that. But he's not an idiot. Remind me about talk radio, okay?
Okay.
All right. Americans United demanded the cross be removed and arguing that its location on city property violates the Constitution by bridging the separation between church and state, which it does. As the preeminent symbol of Christianity, the cross also makes Jews, Muslims, and other non-Christians feel unwelcome in the city. It's pushing Christianity on residents, according to Alec Luckenitzer, who's the associate legal director of Americans United. So what do you think? I mean, I said, get all of this religious stuff out of the public square. I mean, they got churches. You can put it up there. I know in Birmingham, they always had a creche, whatever it is. You know, the manger scene.
Oh, yeah.
And this year, they had a menorah also for the Jewish holiday.
Well, glad they could catch up with the times.
Yes. And a lot of places, the people like the Freedom From Religion Foundation have put secular displays. Tis the season for a reason.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
But it has turned out now, and we were talking earlier, that we think George W. Bush sunk Christianity. Gave it
he
really
sunk
a bad
it all.
Yeah, he sunk
I
it all.
I blame him for everything. And you know what? I'm so tired of this. I hate to say it. I don't mean to be a bah humbug, you guys, but Peter and I are both, or each atheist. And these posts on Facebook about, put the Christ back in Christmas. It's like, we're not taking it away. We're not taking it out of that. It's about mutual respect for all religions of this country
and
the world.
For the first time ever, I have lights.
I put up a tree, but I did it for my boyfriend's kids.
Okay. I had lights because I decided that's pretty pagan.
It is pagan. My tree's, there's not
because,
Christmas.
Because,
there's like one Mickey Mouse Santa on
it. The solstice, right? Oh, yeah. We survived, didn't we? Survived the end of the world. Yeah. But I thought, and then the light's coming back. So that's a good thing.
Yes.
We read last week that atheists around the world suffer persecution. But in the United States now, atheists, non-believers, agnostics, non-churchgoers are the second largest group.
Yeah.
Only Catholics are more. So, you don't have to.
I don't feel like I've been shunned.
Yeah. You know, this is, seems to be the most non-Christmassy Christmas I've ever remembered.
Well, I think it's, you know, the big thing that happened out east. Everyone's still focusing on that. They just laid the last three children to rest.
I never went to a mall.
No.
Well, maybe that's it.
No.
Okay. We're going to take
a
break.
Wait, what? You didn't buy me anything? Come on, Peter.
I'm going to take you to lunch.
Okay, yeah. From my birthday 2 years ago?
Right.
All right.
Absolutely. Awesome. When we come back, I want to talk about where our money's going, right? I mean, we're...
And something about talk radio.
Oh, talk radio. Talk radio. Yeah. This program is going to have a... Well, it's always had a special status, but it's going to have an incredible special status after January 1st, and it's one that I don't want.
What?
Right back.
Oh, yeah. You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
What do you got for me, Doc?
The victim is male, mid-30s, cause of death, sudden shock.
Yeah, well, he was last seen browsing thousands of TV episodes and movies online with Netflix.
Explains the traces of disbelief in the brain, but this astonishment residue...
He was watching them all instantly.
Instantly? That's incredible!
Doctor? Doctor!
Instantly watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on all kinds of devices for only $8 a month with Netflix. Start your free trial today. See terms of use.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Listen up, ladies. Breast augmentation is the number one cosmetic surgery among women. And scarless breast augmentation is a better way to go. Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa has been the number one cosmetic surgeon for the past 20 years. Dr. Gray, why should a woman choose to have the scarless procedure?
My patients prefer to have scarless breast enlargement because, one, it's scarless, my patients have less downtime, there's less risk of any complications, and they can return to their everyday life much sooner.
So what does that mean?
Many patients are back to work the next day. You can return to your activities sooner, exercise sooner, and do the things you love to do. Your results are beautiful, and you're more comfortable while you recover.
Perfect. So how does a woman decide a scarless breast augmentation is right for her?
Come see me for a complimentary consultation. We'll sit down and talk, discuss your situation, and review your options together.
Thanks, Dr. Gray. You can visit anewyou.com to see before and after photos of scarless breast augmentation. For a free consultation with Dr. Gray, call 248-538-3333 or visit anewyou.com.
I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Marcel Tolkowski invented the Ideal Cut Diamond in 1919. Find yours today at Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry.
That's Jared.
The Ideal Cut unlocks the true beauty of the diamond. Invented by Tolkowski, perfected by Tolkowski. And our expert staff can help you create the perfect ring by guiding you through our incredible selection of diamonds at Jared today.
It can only be Jared.
Find a Jared store or shop anytime at Jared.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. And I said I was going to tell you that this program is going to have a special status and one that I'm not very happy about at all. Are you that cold? Do you have your jacket on,
I'm
or are you
freezing
leaving?
In here.
No, turn up the heat. But so what I'm going to do is what we call reset, because I want to encourage people to call in. If you're just joining us now, we were talking some about the NRA and how they are essentially just pimps for the big gun manufacturers and ammunition.
And the Republican Party.
The Republican Party. Right. And how both parties, people in both parties are so fearful of them, but Jolene said that they just did, they put up about $13 million and almost everybody they backed lost.
Yeah, except for one.
Jim writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com regarding the NRA's desire for armed guards in all schools. I say fine, but let it be paid for by taxes on guns and ammo. I don't own a gun. Why should I have to pay for the carnage that they help cause? Tobacco and alcohol are taxed. It's past due that guns and ammo are taxed for the problems that they cause. You know, the NRA was responsible for ending the assault rifle ban. There was, when it was passed in 1996 after some massacre or other, they put a sunset clause in it. It meant that it had a 10-year didn't go on. And, of course, under George W. Bush, they let it expire. So,
of course,
what kind of responsibility for what's happened, for the arming of people like this young man that just shot up the school, do they have?
Yeah, they take no responsibility. I mean, they
because these kids were watching video games.
Yeah, they're in complete denial. We got an email from Brian at calltalkyes@yahoo.com as well. And Brian from Windsor. Hey, Brian. He said he watched the Meet the Press online featuring LaPierre, and he said how plastic he was. He couldn't believe how much he was just kind of dodging every question. And when asked about how the NRA would react to new gun control laws, he just kept on talking as if he was speaking for every American while using the word freedom many times.
If you go to our Facebook page, which is
Facebook.com/nightcall.
Yeah, or my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. You can see this video of when Wayne LaPierre was giving his press conference, and feisty Medea Benjamin and her partner from Code Pink, codepink.org, holds up this sign that says NRA kills children, and Wayne LaPierre just stops, and then for a while he just kept talking with this huge sign in front of him.
She is something else, I tell you.
True.
You know, she's about 4'10", probably, and can't weigh but about 90 pounds, and she is the feistiest little thing in a small body I've ever known. She makes me look tame.
Remember, talk radio. Remember, don't let me forget this.
Talk radio.
Okay.
Well, you did tease. You need to kind of get to that.
We were also talking about the so-called right to work, which is really the right to be irresponsible in the workplace, the right to mooch, the right not to pay for the services that are being rendered for you by a union. And Jim writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, the real purpose of the right to work legislation is to defund the Democratic opposition. That's always, the Republicans have two goals. One, drive everybody's wages down, privatize everything, and destroy the financial and political backing of the Democratic Party. But they're going to have to do something else because they do that all the time. The other thing we were talking about, then we get to talk radio.
Talk radio. What is this? I mean, I don't even know what you're talking about.
All right. A group called Americans United for Separation of Church and State are demanding that the city of Frankenmuth, where it's Christmas 365 days a year, mm-hmm. take down their white 55-foot cross because it's on city property. And paired with that, I'm just going to read the headline of this. It says, census officials citing increasing diversity say the U.S. will be a plurality nation. So we're not going to be a predominantly white Christian nation anymore. Mm-hmm. So think about this. You think, wow, you know, so what? We got a cross there. I mean, how would you like to, you know, in your town, say you're a Christian and you come into town and they have, I don't know what, you know, they have a big Jewish star or they have a big Buddhist symbol or something like that. And that's the only thing they have, right? And what does that tell you? This ain't your town, you know? And I think a lot of those right wingers, they would like to tell the diverse folks that, but hey, you're history, people. You are history.
Peter, you're so funny.
Yeah. And good riddance. Okay. All right. Talk radio. One of the things that any radio station, any broadcaster, no matter what the medium wants, is dominance, total dominance over a market. And Jalene and I will now have it in the city of Detroit because the last liberal talk station is going away.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was one in Detroit.
Your only hope, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, right. There was one station, probably most of you never even heard of it because it was so ill-managed. And she's shaking me off or something. I don't give it.
Don't even bring it up. Don't even talk about it.
Okay. So now, I mean, get this. We live in a state. We live in a state that in which Obama won by 9%.
Yeah.
That the majority of people are Democrats. We live in an area that's predominantly Democratic, that's represented in the main by Democratic representatives. And if it was a fair redistricting, would it be even more? And this is it. for left of center talk radio.
We be it.
Yeah. And do you realize, even with all of that, that the Republicans controlling communication,
yeah,
dominate, you know, they're always saying the liberal media, you know, that even with all of that, that they still can't even pull out electoral victory.
Yeah, it's a company that has, yeah, all the right-wing talk shows so, on it. And we fortunately want to say thank you to Greater Media for continuing to
absolutely
keep this show on the air, because you get that it's important. And you understand that it's also a rich part of the history of this city.
Yeah. There are actually three right-wing talk stations in Detroit.
I mean, really?
Which I think is great.
Who needs that much? Oh, they're infighting.
Oh, well, yeah, because they're splitting the audience.
Yeah.
They'll probably all go away, which is good. Okay.
Now, phone calls.
Phone calls.
We invite you to call the show. We've been rambling. It's 313-298-9743. We have one person on hold. Feel free to call in. We'll take your calls.
All right. It's Fred in Detroit. Fred, welcome to the broadcast. Happy holidays to you.
Hi. We have to shut the radio off right quick. Okay. Now we're just calling in about the fake argument to the gun lobbying.
Okay.
I heard some of the speech.
That you're talking about Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA's talk on Friday.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and basically, some of the talking heads are saying that he's blaming everybody else but the NRA. So I'm just going right along with him, that the whole entertainment industry and, you know, the video games, that's all nonsense. It basically comes down to people and common sense. Now, I believe in what your one of your listeners said. You know, tax the hell out of guns and ammo.
Tax them.
Pay for the security in schools, and schools should have security. Every other institution has it. Banks, office buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, even like the.
You know, but it's certainly
7-11.
Yeah, it's certainly not a completely safe thing. There was an armed security guard at the Columbine High School that shot four times at the two perpetrators, missed every time.
And so we should have at least a couple. We shouldn't just have one. But I also wanted to say that, you know, I don't believe that really the Republicans, they don't want to pay any more for health care than they do all these guys and girls that have been blown up and shot up in Afghanistan and Iraq. They don't want to pay for mental health care. They already gutted it. And I've been hearing people coming out and saying that.
Really?
The Republicans gutted mental health care.
Yeah.
They did. But wait, let me just back up, Fred, a little bit. I don't think I entirely agree with you. I think that there's a culture of violence, and there's a culture of machismo, and and so much of American history has been acted out in terms of violence that the portrayal in popular culture, I think, does have an effect on everybody. What the presence of so many guns has meant, that has allowed that small minority, that vastly teeny minority of people that actually act out these fantasies. But I got to tell you, there's probably, in what you can read in literature, but you know, psychological literature, there are so many people, predominantly men, I have to say, that have these revenge fantasies, these murderous sense that all of the people that have humiliated them or women that have broken up with them.
Yeah, that happens.
And all
my,
of that.
One of my good friends, she's dead because she broke up with a guy.
Yeah.
What the NRA tried to make it sound. I mean, I do agree with you there.
Yeah. So if you have, people joke about the Canadians that they're so passive and they're so polite and everything like that, whereas we're seen as these tough,
savage,
brusque
beasts.
Yeah, right. There's great exceptions to both of it, and stereotypes to be sure. But there seems always to me to be a toughness out of proportion for what's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you have to be ready, as far as I'm concerned, and if I'm remembering right, you were in the Marines, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's a time and place for everything. And,
oh, you have a good memory, Peter.
But to be always tough, to always be on guard, to always be armed, that's disproportionate to chance of threats. Like sometimes when people, you know, I talk to people and they say, well, I'm, you know, I always have a concealed weapon with me. Actually, I was at dinner with a guy just the other night who's the nicest guy in the world and calm and all that. And he said, oh, yeah, I've got a gun right in my
really?
Pocket. Yeah, I pulled it right out. You know, I mean, in a little holster, a little, I can't remember what it was. It was like a small 357 mag. I'm going, huh, well, I hope he, you know, and we were drinking.
I but, hope that.
Yeah. Well, not much. Not much, fortunately.
In a bar?
No, not in a bar.
Okay, thank you.
At their house. But I'm thinking, I don't even want to say where the house was, but this was not a house on the planet that, well, speaking of the planet, you'd have more of a chance of getting hit by a meteor than you would of the necessity of being armed.
And a big, scary dog. I just rescued one 2 days ago. No one's coming in my house. But, no one is coming in my house.
But this guy is sweet, gentle. Nice. I mean, he's a hunter. He has a huge elk's head on his wall.
I'm sure you loved that.
Well, I was okay. I mean, I wasn't.
For a vegetarian, it's kind of weird, though, isn't it? See a stuffed head on the wall.
Yeah, to me, it's a little odd. But you know, everybody's got their hobbies.
God. Yeah, I know. You know,
like that.
I know.
But where was I? Oh, yeah. So people, you know, somebody like way out in Macomb County or something like that. They say, I'm always armed, and I go. You know, when you drive, are you wearing like a crash helmet and a flame retardant suit?
Right.
I mean, I says you got much, much more of a chance of getting in a fiery car crash than you have for any need to have a weapon with you at all times. Can you guarantee the safety of me and my family at all times?
We're having a holiday party. I need to protect my guests.
I don't know. All right. Hey, Fred, you have a happy holiday, huh?
No, you too.
Okay.
Bye-bye, Fred.
All right. Okay. You like that voice? They all talk. They get like that. They go,
you know, one story that we really have to get to tonight, and I don't know if you want to do it now or if we can want to do it at the top of the hour, but the story about the woman who's was fired in, I'm so embarrassed about my home state of Iowa right now. She was fired for being too attractive to her boss.
Yeah, a dentist.
He was attracted to her. And fired her because it was a threat to his marriage. He felt she'd worked for this guy for 10 years, and the court upheld this firing.
Which story do you have? Because you have the New York Times one. There, I don't know what happened to it. There was a longer one in Yahoo that the husband and wife, the dentist and his wife, consulted with their pastor. And the pastor, I don't think it says it now.
No, it doesn't.
And the pastor advised them to fire the woman. But, you know, you can't fire somebody in most states, at least up around here, because of gender discrimination. But they said it was not what I don't have it in front of me, but they said it wasn't gender discrimination at all.
Let's see. These judges sent a message to Iowa women.
This is what their lawyers said.
Yeah, that they don't think men can be held responsible for their sexual desires, and that Iowa women are the ones who have to monitor and control their bosses' sexual desires, said the lawyer.
Yeah.
She was 32 years old, had worked for this Dr. Knight for 10 years. This is probably the craziest thing I've read. All week.
And they had never had sex. And although the guy, the dentist, began texting her stuff, asked how she had orgasms. This was in the other story.
Oh, well, I read the wrong story.
The all-male Iowa court said bosses could fire employees they saw as an, quote, irresistible attraction, even if the employees had not done anything wrong.
Peter, I can't believe you haven't fired me yet. I mean, aren't I as irresistibly attractive as she is? I'm insulted.
I know.
But really, on a serious note, this is so unbelievable. And you know, Iowa, my home state, I'm so proud of them. They have gay marriage. They, you know, they have some cool stuff going on in that state. But then they take themselves back, you know, how many years? 50 years.
Well,
to this.
Here's one of your typical sexually oppressed Christians, right? And I saw, did you see a photograph of her?
Yes,
very attractive woman.
Did. She's very pretty.
Very attractive
blonde,
woman.
Blonde, very nice looking.
So what if that was the case? I mean, what if the guy is just, you know, did that, when that comes across, did that snort?
Yeah, meaning like,
Yeah.
Like he couldn't control his,
He couldn't control himself, yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, it's pretty horrible to do to her.
He needs counseling.
That's... he needs counseling. And what he the only thing I guess that would have been permissible would be if he would say, look, I've got to find you another job because I can't even do teeth because all I'm doing is looking at your
ear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And really, this is a mad story.
So, yeah, it is. But on one hand, here's a guy that is not actually acting on his impulses. But
he confessed to his wife. He went to the pastor.
Yeah, and the pastor said, fire the bitch.
I mean, how Christian is that?
It's not.
That is such a bunch of crap.
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, this has really gone viral online. It took a while.
Did it?
It took a while, but now it's on the main page, you know, yahoo.com or whatever, wherever. It's getting a lot of attention because of its ridiculousness.
Well, you've had a lot of dogs. You've just gotten one. Have you ever gone to obedience school?
Me personally?
You need it, but your dog.
Well, we are going to go.
Well, one of the things, you've probably heard the phrase, is what they want to stop dogs from doing is they want to control, what do they call it?
Like instincts? Or
impulse control.
Impulse, yeah.
Impulse control.
Impulse.
Right. Impulse control. Because so that's, you know, sometimes when they're doing like seeing eye dogs, they want all this distraction because so they don't want the seeing eye dog to run after a squirrel or bark. You know, start trying to jump up on
little kids or whatever.
When you're leading some blind person around.
Yeah.
So maybe guys need that too, impulse control.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And, so, and what form will it be?
Shock collar.
Where do I get myself one of those?
I don't know. So what do you say, folks? Let me see. Okay, we're going to take a break, and we're going to deal a little with the sore loser department. Remember, we were talking the last couple of weeks. That went away quickly. The secession movement on the part of this.
Texas and a bunch of other states. Is that what
all these guys? Ah, we lost. Ah, wow.
Yeah, they were filing for it.
So they wanted to secede. Yeah. So here, this is just an individual, and
we said, "See you later."
Yeah. Adios. But. This is a story. This is about one individual sore loser in Illinois, and it's got a real funny kicker at the end.
Oh,
so we'll be right back. Give us a call in the meantime.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Well, ladies, there's a new secret weapon in the fight against cellulite, and it was developed right here by Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa. Dr. Gray, what's this new secret weapon?
I call it Cellulize. This procedure breaks up irregular fat that sits just below the skin surface. With it, I can help you more effectively reduce this cellulite, and you can look absolutely amazing.
So how does Cellulize break up the fat?
Using a laser, fat is fine-tuned, smoothed, and molded. The heat from the laser also causes tightening of the surrounding skin and tissue. This procedure together with Dermosonic refines and shapes the fat, creating fantastic results.
So how does the person get in touch with you to discuss having this new procedure?
You can come in for a complimentary consultation. We'll discuss your situation and review your options. Together, we will begin the transformation to the new, more beautiful you.
For your complimentary consultation with Dr. Gray, call 248-538-3333 or visit anewyou.com.
I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today and I'll see you tomorrow.
Yes. Sure, you know Christmas is right around the corner. And just like last year, you're freaking out. And also like last year and the 41 years before it, the Riff is here for you. Hit WRIF.com today and give the gift of Riff gear. Limited edition WRIF Made in Detroit gear makes a perfect gift for him or her. Hats, hoodies, thermals, each the perfect accessory for the harsh Detroit winter. With the added bonus of no fist fighting over that last parking spot at the mall.
Super sparkly day.
Order now at WRIF.com. Then stop worrying and, you know, get back to what the holiday season is all about.
Like, your drunk ass is so great to be around.
Oh, great. Whatever the hell you want.
Outstanding. Riff gear, built by Made in Detroit. Available now at WRIF.com. Listen to score your free tickets for Trans-Siberian Orchestra, one of their two shows, matinee or evening, this Saturday at the Palace of Auburn Hills. Listen and win from your concert station, 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Hey, it's Meltdown. The biggest New Year's Eve bash in Metro Detroit is happening with 101 The Riff at Albert's on the Alley in Garden City. Tons of fun, prizes, including your chance to fly away and escape the snow and ice of Michigan. New Year's Eve at Albert's on the Alley, Middle Belt north of Ford Road in Garden City. For more details, hit us up online at WRIF.com.
Starting fresh right here, right now.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Bingo, that's the one.
Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Oh, I got Jen on my microphone, don't I? Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Join us at that number. A number of issues we're talking about. The NRA, right to work. Snyder's, the governor of Michigan, Governor Rick Snyder. The, what does he call himself? The something nerd? Oh, I got to turn your mic on.
How about mine, too?
Yeah, go ahead.
Jeez. You're slipping.
I am. What the what nerd? He calls himself the something nerd.
I don't know. I don't care.
Anyways, yeah. People don't. Yeah, his popularity is in the toilet. A lot of people are talking about challenging him too for the governor when re-election next year as well, including Jeffrey Feiger.
Yeah, yeah. He always kind of has rumblings of running, doesn't he?
If you don't know who he was Jack Kevorkian's lawyer. And if you don't know who Jack Kevorkian is, I'm not.
You're under a rock.
Yeah. Anyway, we were talking about this Iowa Supreme Court that upheld the firing of a woman whose boss found her too attractive. He was...
After 10 years of working together.
Yeah, all of a sudden he went,
holy.
And John says she didn't think she was that attractive.
I mean, she's... She's not ugly.
Well, I mean... She's pretty. I think she's a nice-looking woman.
She is. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, this is not the only case like this. Deborah Lee Lorenzana. So this is from a Guardian article from a year ago. Likes a dress sharp when she goes to work. She is a fan of Burberry and Hermes and has five closets full of well-fitting dresses and skirt suits. And what the New York banker hadn't anticipated was that in some workplaces, looking good can earn you the sack. Lorenzana claims in a sex discrimination.
And wait, you don't mean in the sack. You mean you're gone.
Yeah, that's weird they put that. Earn you the sack. Huh. Maybe that was...
They will sack you.
Tongue in...
it's British.
Yeah. Lorenzana claims in a sex discrimination suit against Citibank that Citibank dismissed her in part because her figure and her clothes were, quote, too distracting for her male colleagues and supervisors to bear.
God, I got to quit wearing these mini skirts to work.
Yes, you do.
What am I doing?
I can't even... I can't, what, yeah, no. Documents lodged with the court complain that two of her immediate bosses told her to stop wearing turtleneck tops, pencil skirts, fitted business suits, or any other form of tailored attire. When she protested that other women in the office wore the same kind of clothes as her, they allegedly replied that other women could wear what they like as their general unattractiveness rendered moot their sartorial choices.
Crazy.
Unlike Lorenzana, whose shapeliness could not be heightened by beautifully tailored clothing.
Unbelievable.
Further humiliation followed her lawyer's contest because she was relatively tall, 5'6", and had a curvaceous figure. She was told not to wear high-heeled business shoes, as this purportedly drew attention to her body in a manner that was upsetting to her easily distracted male manager.
Well, these poor babies. I'm sorry you can't control your ding-dong. I mean, please, get a life.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Here's Jerry in Chesterfield. Go ahead, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yeah, I know this Jerry out of Chesterfield.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Jerry.
My comment is guns don't kill people. People kill people. And I'm
Wow. Wait.
Let me
I want to digest this one.
Hold on. I got to think about it.
People don't kill.
Yeah,
all right.
Okay.
Guns don't kill people. People kill people.
With guns.
With guns. How about cars don't kill people?
People driving cars.
People kill. What would you say then?
But as far as that goes, I must ban pencils for all our misspelled words.
What? Anyway,
Pencils for the misspelled words?
If, listen, Jerry, if there were no, if no one had any guns, then no one would kill anybody with guns, right?
Well, they just started everyone doing it. Maybe a bomb or something.
Well, they have. People have done that. In fact, the largest mass murder in Michigan was done by a school teacher who drove like a wagon or something with a bomb up. Yeah. Well, I don't know. What does that tell us about the current debate that people ought to have any kind of weaponry and ammunition and magazines that they want?
I'm not saying any kind. You know, some stuff should be done for military purposes, but
yeah. Well, okay. Then we agree. But guns, people with guns kill people. All right. Thanks, Jerry from Chesterfield. Rick Snyder says he's one tough nerd. That's right. He says he's a tough nerd.
Thanks right. there, Rick.
Okay. But, oh, by the way, John, who's taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF, he said, and I, you know, this is pretty sexist in itself, right? Judging women's, men aren't supposed to do
Why
that.
Why are you paying attention to my tatas? It's none of your business.
Well, sometimes it's hard. Look, I'm a guy, you know, and sometimes,
well, you know,
I've totally lost where this is though, but, Oh yeah, here, the New York banker. She is really a very, very attractive woman.
Oh, the one with the other lawsuit?
The other lawsuit, yeah.
Okay.
I think I ought to stop looking at her and just get on with the
Peter!
Show?
Peter!
Okay. God. All right. Okay. Well, oh, yeah, we were going to give...
You're proving these people's point.
Right. Well, you know what I think? I mean, men ought to act in a way everywhere. First off, the number one rule is men should never touch another person without permission.
People shouldn't, really. I'm kind of a touchy-feely person. That's terrible, but only with people I know.
Yeah. But a lot of problems in the world would be solved if men didn't touch other people without, that would include with bullets, because
yes.
then you wouldn't have any wars or anything like that.
Yes.
Right.
Whole personal
however, how, and men should not do anything, particularly in the workplace these days, that make, or anywhere, that make women feel uncomfortable.
Well, there's kind of some little things called laws about it these days.
And, but on the other hand, there is a genetic drive to reproduce.
Right. I know. But you can think it.
Yeah.
But you don't have to act upon it.
Impulse control.
Yeah, control yourself.
Yeah. Well, most guys do.
Well, sure they do.
I'm just, what am I doing? I'm just looking at, I'm looking
get
at Google.
Out of there.
All I got are these websites with babes on them. All right, here's one of the experts, Maurice from Detroit. Go ahead, Maurice. Happy holidays to you. Hey, Maurice. He's busy shooting somebody, probably.
What?
All right, here's Chad and Gail.
Oh, because he has guns?
Yeah. Wait a minute. I still have Maurice on the line, and we're going to have to
try to get him back.
Yeah, but wait a minute here. Let me see.
Maurice will come back to you.
Yeah, we got to. Can I do this? Why can't? All right, okay. I think Maurice is ready. But, well, in the meantime, we'll go to Chad and Gail. Chad, hi, you're on the air. Chad, are you?
Hi, this is Chad.
Are you calling from Chesterfield?
No, I just want to hit the subject of the guy from Chesterfield was talking about.
Okay.
No, this is a different guy, yeah. Hi.
So go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, what you're trying to get at is, you know, like, stupid people with guns kill people.
There you go. And mentally
angry.
Ill people.
Yeah.
Angry people. And the problem is that the more guns you have and the more easily accessible they are, the more that the people that are stupid, mentally ill, angry, acting out are going to act on it. That's why we have the highest murder rate of any industrial country, any developed country. That's why 80% of the children that are murdered in the industrialized world are murdered in the United States. And I just don't understand why people don't see this as a major problem. And what does people...
I think people are so threatened that they're going to have their guns taken away. They can't see this. They can't see through it.
Yeah, no one's going to take away anybody's guns. And as I said at the beginning of the show, that everybody who wants one of these weapons of war is going to be able to get one. They got one. They went out and bought it. They cleaned the shelves.
Last week.
They cleaned the shelves off.
Well, first, after the election, the first election of Obama, and then the second election of Obama, and then after this mass murder.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Chad. I appreciate it. Oh, yeah. I just wanted to, about the sore loser department.
Yeah.
And we were talking about these people that want to secede. You know, get over it. It's what happens when you lose. I mean, that's what the South did to begin with, the 1860 election. Lincoln won, and they said, I got an idea. Let's start a civil war.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, right. And that's the mentality of a lot of these right-wingers now. But well, here's one. Jim Harris in Genoa, Illinois, expected vandalism, angry calls, and maybe even a violent attack because he put two huge signs on his lawn saying, no hope, and enslaved by the 47%.
He also erected an upside-down American flag. Which is a military sign of dire distress.
Yeah. He says, I feel this country is in dire distress. An Air Force veteran who earns more than $40 an hour is a non-union construction worker. Usually, if you're non-union, you make it about eight bucks an hour. Is there any of you folks out there that that work construction that would tell me what in the world anybody in a small town in Illinois would be making 40 bucks an hour doing construction? But these are deflated times, says this article. Deflated times for many ultra-conservatives and Tea Party crusaders who felt certain that America had come to its senses it was going to make a sharp turn right in the polls in November. Boy, did they have the rug pulled out from under them. The display of upside-down flags as a protest strikes a raw chord with Terry Vance, a highly decorated and disabled Vietnam War veteran, who serves as the adjunct quartermaster of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Illinois. A lot of us fought and died for freedom of speech, Mr. Vance said. But it seems to me there are a lot more respectful ways to express your political opinions. Whether you like the president or not, he is the commander-in-chief of the United States of America. Well, one thing I would correct him on. He is not the commander-in-chief of the United States of America. He's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and that is extraordinarily important. And like Don McIntyre, the president of the DeKalb County Tea Party, says, we're in shock after the election.
Get over it.
Too bad. For a Republican Party eager to avoid an extremist image, not extremist image.
No, they are extremist. They are
extremist, yeah. Some political experts say the upside-down flags are not welcome. Paul Green, a political science professor at Roosevelt University in Illinois, says things like upside-down flags and talk of succession are not helpful. The fringe, and both parties, have a fringe. I would ask you, dear friends, what is the left-wing fringe of the Democratic Party? The Democratic Party does not have a left-wing fringe. I mean, you might say Jolene and I, but we're not in the Democratic Party. We don't consider ourselves Democrats.
Right. I mean, I don't feel fringe either.
They're centrists, the Democrats are.
A lot of people who feel the same way we do.
Yeah. They're like barely center-left. And so what's the people have to say what do they call it, equivalency. That somehow, well, you know, they have all these absolutely mad people in the Republican Party. By mad, I mean crazy. I wish I could say that word.
Crazy old bat. Crazy.
Yeah.
White.
That are just totally out of their minds. Just driven by political paranoia and all that. There's nobody like that in the Democratic Party. I'm not trying to say there's not far left wingers and people like that, communists, socialists, anarchists, and all that. But they're not in the Democratic Party. Some socialists are, I guess. But even like Bernie Sanders, who's a socialist.
Yeah. Cool.
The independent. He doesn't want to be in the Democratic Party.
Right.
He's an independent from the state of Vermont. Anyway,
he's cool. Like him.
Now, Mr. Harris, the guy that has the signs. Oh, Bernie Sanders, the best in the whole country.
Oh, yeah.
Who has the sign up saying, no hope and enslaved by the 47%.
He's going to leave that flag hanging upside down for the next 4 years, Peter.
Hope he has it. Does he take it down every night?
It says, in fact, he's planning on getting a bigger one. Well, it's upside down. Why do all that whole...
Yeah. You know? Well, you know, there's all these rules about the American flag, and either you have to take it down every night or you have to illuminate it.
Right. Well, you know, he said it's... I thought this was amazing because he's trying to get a response out of people. He said it's not been the lightning rod he anticipated. The flag has elicited an exasperated shrug from his eldest daughter, Ashley, 25, he said, but not much else. She just kind of rolled her eyes and said, oh, Dad.
And let me see. He's.
I'd say, oh, Dad, you crazy son of a bitch.
He's a divorced father of four daughters, a former soccer coach and referee. Said he wanted to make it plain that he is not some kind of wacko. And he, yeah, so his daughter just okay. rolled his eyes. You missed the last page. He added with a wince, my daughter voted for Obama.
Yeah. That's tough. I mean, you know, my dad is a Republican, diehard Republican.
How did he feel? How did he feel? I mean, was he devastated or?
No, I think he kind of expected it. Really? I don't know. The thing is, we're trying not to talk about politics in the interest of our father-daughter relationship. We've yeah. been on that roll for a bunch of years after we got into a big old, during George Bush years, we had a big old wine-fueled argument. Red wine. God, that was some good wine. But it ended up, we're crying and the whole thing, and then we just decided we can't talk about it anymore, you know? And, but, you know, my dad may be a Republican, but he's a wonderful man.
He is.
And he is not nuts enough to put up a sign in his yard like that.
And plays a good, what does he play?
He plays a mean steel guitar.
Steel guitar.
Yes,
right.
He does.
He does. He does. All right. I think Maurice is ready. Maurice, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter, Jalene, how you doing?
We're
doing
Maurice. Good. Maurice.
Let's talk about guns. Only thing I tell you, some people don't need them, some people do.
You know, you're right about that.
Some folks know
you're
about
right
it.
You're right about that.
Some folks know about it, some don't.
No, but he's right about that.
Yeah.
I've got something shocking to tell both of y'all. Not too long ago, I was involved in an attempted robbery.
Really?
At your cab?
Yeah, I can't really talk about it because I'm going to court. They say the guy's in the hospital with a couple of holes in him, and I'm still driving the cab.
Okay, well, that I just figured that whole thing out in my head, Peter.
Yeah, sure.
Did you?
Sure.
Maurice. I'm glad you're okay.
You might get a...
I'm glad no one died.
You might get a mention in The Rifleman, the NRA publication, because they spotlight when people have used guns successfully in...
To protect...
Well, Maurice, you have a happy holiday.
On that note.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. On that note.
He made Swiss cheese out of someone. I'm amazed they're alive.
Yeah. Here's Reverend Shortcut from Washington Township, the home of the Octagon House.
Oh, God.
Reverend, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
We're good.
I live right by the Octagon House.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
You
make the story sexier then.
Yeah. I knew a guy that used to call people from Washington Township, and he would call people, his main insult, he'd call people Octagon Head. He says, you Octagon Head.
I don't get it.
Well, never mind. Go ahead.
Listen, Peter, right now as we're talking, there's probably nuclear missiles, pointed at America, and we're pointing them at the Soviets.
What do you mean, probably? They are at Russia.
Well, I'm just saying probably because I don't want to scare you.
Well, I know they are.
I want you, okay, if you know they are, then that's good.
Yeah.
Then each one can disperse. They have multiple warheads that can disperse about 50 nukes per rocket.
Right.
So what that means is they can destroy, say, an area of about anywhere from 30 to 50 square miles around you if they fall. So you're looking at total destruction. I mean, you're looking at melting the United States or the Soviet Union. Why are we so worried about handguns? That's my question to you. Why are we so worried about handguns?
Well,
we're more worried about assault rifles.
Actually, or handguns, assault rifles, whatever. It takes a catastrophe always of some proportions in order for people to begin to address a particular subject. Like, people have been warning about the dangers of offshore drilling forever. Mm-hmm. And, it was the concern of a few environmentalists and people like that. Suddenly, after this BP spill, then everybody was concerned. Of course, whoa. And this is what will happen now.
Well, everyone's so compartmentalized in their thinking.
Yeah. And one of the things that will happen, Rev, is that this time they might even pass some, weak bill. You know, they would maybe extend background checks, try to deal with these rogue gun dealers.
More of a wait time.
Yeah. All of this stuff. But nothing too much is going to change. And very few people are addressing the fact that, as you correctly indicate, that there are nuclear missiles pointed right now at the United States. They're, as far as we know, they're not on active, shoot on, what do they call it? What do these call that? Launch on I can't remember, but that was the whole deal, that there, because of that these nukes were all on hair triggers during the Cold War, that there was a couple of times that people had to either launch them or lose them. And
wow.
So the fact that the United States still has this enormous nuclear arsenal, thank you.
Yeah, and the thing is, remember, they were trying to say that we made this agreement with Russia and we got rid of the nukes. They didn't get rid of the nukes. They stored them away.
And the United States was just doing some sort of tests with them. So, all right, Rev, thanks. But one of the things should happen, I mean, right now that Obama is calling on Russia to renew this 20-year-old nuclear disarmament program, that Russia is threatening to cancel because the United States is doing things under Obama. This isn't George Bush. I mean,
we're messing around in that area.
Yeah,
we're pissing Russia off.
We're putting nukes and not nukes, but missile defense shields. Which could be
by Poland.
Yeah, by Poland and Czechoslovakia and what have you. And what the United States ought to be doing is taking the lead on complete nuclear disarmament. Because again, why does Great Britain need nuclear weapons? Why does France need nuclear weapons?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't China be willing to sign a complete disarmament pact? It's the United States, essentially. The United States and Israel that wants to maintain nuclear arsenals. Okay. Let's go to here's Rory. Rory's in Richmond. Go ahead, Rory. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just was listening to you guys. And the river from Washington Township doesn't make any sense. I mean, that's what the Cold War was about, was Russia disarming their nuclear weapons. So for him to say that, he sounds ignorant. To me, he sounds like an anti-gun activist. And, I'm a hunter. I'm a sports shooter. And, I'm an all-around gun activist. I agree that, everybody has the right to bear arms, and I think people should. And it's going to be those people that we worry about, because they're going to look to us, the people who have guns, to protect them when something hits the fan, And the countries that he should be worrying about, or people should worry about for nuclear disarmament, is Iran and North Korea, places like that. That's just like the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
They were worried about Cuba getting nuclear missiles. I mean.
Well, the deal was, though.
Can we just all say together, nuclear?
In the United States, tactical nuclear weapons in Turkey. So the United States was beginning to surround the Soviet Union with nuclear missiles. I mean, the United States was the aggressor during the Cold War. It wasn't the Soviet Union. And one of the things they wanted was this quid pro quo. In other words, if it's okay for the United States to come 8,000 miles away and put nukes right on the border of the Soviet Union, why couldn't Russia come and do it in Cuba as well? And what happened? I mean, Kennedy backed down. I mean, this whole thing that Kennedy backed the Russians down, the Kennedy really backed down and agreed to take these missiles out of Turkey. This was, this has just come out. It's been like the 50th anniversary. But the United States, remember, it's the only country that ever used it, didn't need to use it to get Japan to surrender, and ought to lead the way to nuclear disarmament. All right, thanks a lot. What's wrong with being anti-gun?
I call it anti-gun violence.
Yeah, or even whatsoever. So you're an anti-gun person, other people are pro. What's the difference? Hey, we're still frittering away our fortune. And the problem that with nukes isn't Iran or is not North Korea. Although, who knows? I mean, are these people that crazy? I mean, nobody's going to launch anything against the United States because they would be obliterated, right? And I've said this every time we talk. If you don't have weapons of mass destruction, then you get invaded like Iraq. If you do have them, like North Korea, we say, hey, can let's talk about it. Can we make a deal? Come
negotiate.
On, let's negotiate. So if I was Iran, because the United States goes and makes wars on the border of Iran, of Iraq and Afghanistan, right? They both border Iran. Could you imagine, like I always say this, China fighting a war in Honduras and Guatemala, right? Something like that. Or imagine if they had a North American command, China, the Chinese military, had a North American command in the way that the United States has
now
a South American.
Right, all over the world.
That if we had, if the Chinese had warships off the coast of the United States all the time. I mean, think about that. So, I mean, the idea that the Defense Department is about defense, or that, you know, that we're this peaceful nation. I mean, the United States is all around the world, and we should be right here. We shouldn't be spending our money as we are on this, for instance, this $633 billion military bill for next year. I can't even do the math.
God.
So that's 10 years. They're always talking about 10 years. It's fiscal cliff. Do we have enough money? You know, there's a debt. There's a deficit. I guess that comes out to something like $6 trillion for this military-industrial complex to go, you know, around the world.
Remember when it was $80 billion when it started out in
Iraq?
Yeah,
I guess so.
In Iraq, I remember. We were astounded when we were doing our syndicated talk show at the $80 billion number.
Right.
And now we knew this was going to happen.
This bill also tightens penalties on Iran over its nuclear ambitions. Why shouldn't Iran, tell me this, why shouldn't Iran be allowed to have nuclear weapons if Israel has them? For instance, isn't that kind of tit for tat?
Yeah.
Right? Why should Iran, or why should North Korea not have nuclear weapons if Great Britain and France and China have them? I mean,
what gives?
What gives?
How is this all decided?
Yeah. Actually, the White House threatened a veto despite solid bipartisan support in the House and Senate for the sweeping policy measure that spends $1.7 billion more than President Obama requested to cover the cost of ships, aircraft, weapons, and military personnel. So this is all part of the racket. You know, this is part of the racket which the military-industrial complex is, because what if you go deep enough into this, this is all about just getting military facilities in different districts. And so all these Republicans that vote probably 100% for this, they say, oh, we're against any stimulus, any government stimulus that would put billions of dollars into the economy that would rebuild our infrastructure and what have you. That's socialism. This is socialism. It's military socialism. It is the stimulus to the economy. It's a weak one and doesn't work well, and it really just robs our states and our cities and our communities of what we need. But it is how many times have I said this? A transfer of personal wealth to the state that then allocates it to private corporations that make all these, all the military weapons and all of this. And get this.
It's a big racket.
Get this headline here. I mean, you're not going to believe this. In a sign of normalization, the Pentagon to reimburse Pakistan.
Oh, I couldn't believe it.
$688 million.
Said, thank you for letting us park our asses there.
Yeah, yeah. Matt, you know, every time we talk about this, I talk about our little suburb needs $3 million, and then we can get the first responders back that have been laid off.
Yeah.
And we, you, me, Jalene, everybody listening, is giving this incredibly vile nation, I mean, not the people, but the government.
Yes.
That is in league with the Taliban half the time, the intelligence services are. We're giving them $688 million. And, Jalene put it best, parking our ass, 140,000 troops.
Thanks for the parking spot.
And we're putting John Kerry, the Democrat of Massachusetts, who is going to be the Secretary of State. He was a co-author of a law that authorized 5 years and about $7.5 billion of non-military assistance to Pakistan.
Mm.
Can't give it to our little cities. They can't give it to Detroit. They can't give it to Flint.
Then there's all those entitlements, Peter.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
That these so-called entitlements. Oh, wait. Take care of your people? Take care of the poor? Take care of the elderly,
no.
Women and children? Oh, no.
The Marine version of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter is going to cost us, can you believe this, $396 billion over the next 20 years.
Wow.
This is where our money goes, right? In the meantime, this is from our friends at Peace Action of Michigan. Pentagon contractors spent $50 million lobbying Congress during the first 9 months of 2012. You ready for that?
That's a lot of money.
So here are these companies, Drummond and all these aerospace and missile manufacturers and all that. They spent $50 million just on lobbying. And they go, So they must realize that that's going to be just a small portion of what they're going to reap back. So,
oh, they definitely do.
So we need enemies.
It's big business.
Yeah, if we need enemies. If we don't have the enemies, well,
then these people don't make any money.
Right. Okay. Here is Christopher in Detroit. Hi, Christopher. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're good.
Hey, I just wanted to talk to you about what you said about China and U.S. warships in Chinese waters.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to say first that I agree with just about everything you say, although I just wanted to correct you on this.
Sure.
I think that that's a bit of a false equivocation. I mean, China has a direct territorial claim on Taiwan.
Yeah.
And without a U.S. presence there, basically Taiwan doesn't exist anymore.
Well, what if the situation was a little different and China was going to, like, protect Puerto Rico or something like that? I mean, you know, Taiwan was an integral part of, I mean, this goes way back to the 1940s when the communist, it was a province. Taiwan was a province of China. I don't think that China has any right to militarily take it over, but you really want to spend American fortune and, perhaps American lives to protect Taiwan? I mean, I don't know whether how old you are, but whether you got any kids or relatives or anything like that.
I mean, I'm 27. I am in the Marine Corps. I mean, I did sign up for this. But, I don't know. I guess that depends on what you feel about, how the U.S. should project their force abroad.
Well, I don't think it should project its force abroad at all.
Yeah, I mean, how many bases do we have around the
800
bases?
How many bases
around the world?
Does China have around the world? How many bases does Russia have? Russia has a few, not very many, 5-6 or something
but
like that.
But we are everywhere.
I mean, we're just running around the world making...
Why are we still in Germany?
Yeah, why are we in Germany? Why are we in South Korea? Why are we in Japan? Why are we, you know, why do we have hundreds and hundreds of bases?
Why are we in Guam?
Yeah.
I mean, are you sincerely asking those questions? I mean, like...
Yeah.
Okay. But I think that we're in these countries because basically there's no one else that can do it. There's no one else that... Really
wait, why does anybody have to do it? The United States is in there, all these... you know, when you get off the line, look up a Marine commandant from the who was in the early part of the 20th century through the 1930s. His name is Smedley... What a weird first name. Smedley Butler. He was the commandant of the Marines for about 25 years.
Yeah, he won two congressional...
So you do know him, and you know his statement about what his role with the Marines was?
I suppose he made a lot of them, but which one are you talking about?
Well, you know what I'm going to do? I got to go to a commercial. I'm going to find it online, and I will read it when we come back. All right, Christopher, thank you, and whatever, stay safe. All right, we shall be right back with Smedley Butler's remarks.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. How would you like to see customers through your door today and the next day and the day after that? I have the answer you're looking for. RiffDeals.com. Hey, you're online now. Just click on the banner in the player window to find out more. Remember, there's no upfront cost to you. It's a partnership, but your success is the goal. WRAF's marketing pros work with you to develop the perfect deal. Then, RiffDeals.com uses the power of on-air, online, and social media marketing to help you reach new customers. Oh, did I mention that you get a check within 10 days of your successful deal running? That's cash in your pocket and customers in the door.
Honey, why are you calling me so late? It's kind of hard to talk right now. Honey, why are you crying? Is everything okay? I gotta whisper cause I can't be too loud. Oh well, my girl's in the next room. Sometimes I wish she was you. I guess we never really moved on. It's really good to hear your voice. Saying my name, it sounds so sweet. Coming from the lips of an angel.
WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. It's our final segment. I'll have a couple of interviews at the top of the hour. And if you want to find out what they are, you can go to our Facebook page, Facebook.com/Night Call, or my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And thank you, John. He will have a podcast available in 11 and a half hours on our Facebook site. So we were talking about General Smedley Butler, who in 1935 published a book called War is a Racket. And you think, wow, that's pretty rad. But it was actually condensed by Reader's Digest. But here's, it's very long. And I, for a minute, I couldn't find the part I was looking for. But here, he says, like all members of the military profession, I never had a thought of my own until I left the service. My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed the orders of higher-ups. This is typical with everyone in the military service. This was the commandant. A commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps. And he says, and here's what I was talking about, and it is no different today. Why we are fighting. There's a great documentary called Why We Fight.
Yeah.
So this is...
It took me a long time to watch that because it's an emotional
yes.
issue.
This is the commandant of the Marine Corps back, way back. He says, I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909-1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see that Standard Oil went its way unmolested, and it goes on and on like this. Mm-hmm. So it's General Smedley. S-M-E-D-L-E-Y, Smedley Butler, and they even have films of him talking. I mean, he's an incredible and impressive figure. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Levi in Port Huron. Hey, Levi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, guys. Merry Christmas.
Well, same to you.
Yeah, I was just listening as I got out of work and pulling into my driveway home. My props to you guys on history, especially from the Commandant of the Marine Corps. But, I mean, that book was written, what, in 36?
Yeah, for 35, yeah.
35, 36-ish. But you got to understand something. I mean, he's kind of off on that because I'm an Army veteran myself. I did 8 years. I did two in Iraq. And honestly, I started waking up and having my own thoughts while I was in the service. Uh-huh. And
really?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great people in the military that open up your eyes to stuff, what's going on. I got out because I got tired of all the political BS I had to deal with. But going back to what the Commandant says, I mean, we think for ourselves. I mean, everybody in the military nowadays is pushing for education. They want us to think on our own.
Sure.
I mean, if you look at the difference between German soldiers and American soldiers in the Second World War, we won D-Day. Just because everybody knew the battle plan, because everybody thought on their own. The Germans, they still had senior leadership officers that they were still asleep, so their troops didn't know what to do. And that's the difference between our military and everybody else's, even today.
Mm-hmm.
We're free thinkers, and you can't stop us from doing it.
Well, but one of the things...
They can try.
In any hierarchical outfit, that one has to follow the orders. I mean, you may have agreed that the war in Iraq was based on a bunch of George Bush lies, but you didn't have any option other than to be there when ordered, and the main thing was to keep you and your comrades alive, right?
You know, that's debatable, because half of us feel that it was BS, other half of us feel that it doesn't. You know,
it's a fact. It's a fact that this was based on lies.
Well, but the point being is you didn't have any say in whether... there was no political debate.
They said,
there.
You're going there, and you went there.
You didn't want to vote. You say, well, wait a minute. I think George Bush just made this all up, and so I don't want to go. Yeah, well, obviously, you couldn't do that, right?
I personally wanted to go.
Why would you?
I'm one of those rare ones. I was from the childhood. I was born in combat boots. I've always wanted to be in the service.
Okay, but now, how do you feel after having been there in a war based on lies?
What war isn't based on lies?
Well,
in the 20th century.
Yeah, but this was blatant. This was blatant. The American people were lied to. Peter and I knew it all along that it was a bunch
of...
a lot of people, but Peter, I would say at the time after 9/11 that most people were so keyed up by what went on there that they were going to buy any BS that was thrown their way.
The BS that we got fed is actually a technicality. You did find weapons of mass destruction, but...
Wait, the definition...
There were none.
No, let me explain. The definition of a weapon of mass destruction is one component able to do mass destruction. You did find factories full of anthrax, and then you go down the road a little bit, you find the Scud missile factories.
Wait a minute.
No.
I don't want to go on with this. I mean, we don't want to argue about facts. They never found anything. They knew there was nothing there, and in fact, if they would have thought that there really were weapons of mass destruction, they wouldn't have invaded. On the other hand, what if they did have weapons of mass destruction? What in the world do us 8,000 miles away from those folks have to do with what's going on there
in Iraq when it wasn't even Iraqis who hijacked those planes? These were Saudi Arabians.
Yeah.
But those are our buddies, right?
I got to move on. Thank you, Levi.
I could do this all night.
I can't. Here's Rick in Farmington Hills. Rick, how are you?
Hey, how you guys doing? Merry Christmas to you.
Well,
hey, you too.
Yeah.
I just had to call in. I was in the service, 82nd Airborne. Let's just look at it like this. We're the Federation, baby. Next is the galaxy. And that's all it is to it.
That's where I can't believe I even get that, but I do.
Yeah.
Wherever we need it, that's where we're going.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say where we're needed right now is Farmington Hills and Southfield,
that's right.
And Oak Park and Ferndale.
The city of Detroit, my friend.
The city of Detroit and Taylor and St. Clair Shores and all that. And good holidays to you as well, Rick. Thanks. I appreciate your call. You know, here's something. I have this this photographer friend, Rebecca. He was your friend, too.
Sure.
She always, I don't know, you know what? Wonder if she's listening. You know, she always sends me stuff about helmet safety. And all of a sudden, it just clicked why. Someone very dear to her suffered catastrophic. She's been sending me stuff on helmet safety.
Oh, now you
all of a sudden, it just clicked in, yeah. This is from MLive. Any of you folks ever checked out? I think you go to blog.mlive.com. Good site for local stuff. If you thought the debate over requiring motorcycle riders to wear helmets ended when Governor Rick Snyder signed the repeal into law earlier this year, think again. John Barnes, MLive's statewide coordinator of in-depth reporting projects, worked with our reporters across Michigan to tell what happened during the first 6 months after this 35-year-old state law was thrown out. Barnes said, when Michigan lifted its helmet mandate, we began looking at crash rates involving those with and without helmets. He says, we obtained records on crashes dating to 2008, about 19,000 in all, and focused most closely on those after the helmet mandate was lifted in April. There were more than 3,000 motorcycle crashes, both with and without helmets in Michigan, since the state's helmet requirement was repealed in April. Man, I mean, what was it? This year, was it? Signed earlier? So So there have been 3,000 motorcycle crashes since April.
God.
At least 700 of these involve riders or passengers without helmets. So this is interesting. About 75% of motorcyclists in crashes wore helmets, a higher number than some predicted. Everybody thought they were just going to throw them away. Motorcyclists without helmets were three times more likely to die and 43% more likely to suffer serious injuries than those wearing helmets. Compared to 2011 data, Michigan saw a 10% increase in deaths and serious injuries as a result of all motorcycle crashes in 2012 to date. Michigan law has a loophole allowing motorcycle riders to avoid safety classes or road tests that are required to be fully certified. Well, you know, the two crashes I had, they were both just cars that didn't see me and just, you know, fortunately my wife and I walked away from each of them. We had leathers, full leathers and helmets on.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't see you guys.
I'll show you photographs. Yeah. You
know. I gotta see this.
Particularly my wife, right?
I've only seen you in your, like, bicycle shorts.
Yeah, no, that yeah.
That was good enough.
But, no, you know, call me a wimp, man, but that was enough for me. You know, I mean, I just thought, hey.
Heck yeah.
You know, I was, walked away from two of them. I got some scars in my leg.
I kind of have a little rule. Like, if I'm in a relationship with someone, I don't want, there's no motorcycle. Yeah. I know it's the fear.
And you know.
Yeah, I have fear. Well, I don't want to ride on it either.
You know that friend of ours, the wine expert, that just crashed crashed in Austin, Texas,
right
not
there.
Wearing a helmet and had, was lucky. He had a head injury, but, I guess is recovering. Yeah. So. Guys, wear your helmets. And one of the reasons, for instance, the insurance companies, of course, were always for the helmet law. That they increases their payouts, and when they have to increase their payouts, they raise the rates.
Yeah, exactly.
For all of us. Right. So, this item, I've been trying to get to this for a couple of weeks. You know, Walmart is. The more you find out about this. Grotesque, almost criminal organization, the worse it gets. One of the things, and I don't know, this is maybe not common knowledge, but I think a lot of people know. You know, they pay their people so little that on their bulletin boards, they instruct people on how to apply for Medicare. Medicaid.
Yes.
Medicaid, yeah. Yep. And food stamps and stuff like that. So,
I mean, that says it all right there, Peter.
So, it says this article, Walmart pushes workers onto Medicaid as Obamacare architect goes to bid. Well, wait a minute. This is, the headline's crazy. But what they're doing is that they push their workers onto Medicaid. Let me see if this is, Mark Wheeler, who in the Huffington Post. Walmart, the nation's largest private employer, plans to begin denying health insurance to newly, this is about Obamacare. Plans to begin denying health care insurance to newly hired employees who work fewer than 30 hours a week, according to a copy of the company's policy that the Huffington Post got. Walmart is effectively shifting the cost of paying for its employees onto the federal government with this new plan, which is one of the problems with the way the law is structured. So, these big companies are actually using this law that's trying to help the American people to increase their profitability structure, if you can imagine that. I mean, they make billions.
It's just so dirty.
Yeah, they are. Let's see. What Huffington Post doesn't mention in its piece, though, on this is that this is all presumably by design. Walmart, after all, was one of the partners that began pushing for Obamacare. They wanted it because they knew
that they'd take over all of their health care costs.
What I don't understand is that why, when this was first suggested, when modern nations, industrialized nations like Britain and all that, back in the late 40s and early 50s, why that all of these big corporations didn't jump on this and say, whoa. The government paying for the health care that right now.
Yeah, true.
Say, like General Motors, they're in these heavy negotiations with the United Auto Workers in 1950 or something like that. And they're thinking, you know what? If the government paid for this, we could be making a lot more money.
Mm.
But I don't know. I wonder if anybody has ever really thought about this. Walmart, the family worth $107 billion, and they're trying to play the angles. That's what kills me.
I mean, that's just, these people are disgusting.
You know, they are. This is back in, I guess it was the late 19th century, earliest 20th century, is that the first Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, who was the equivalent of the first billionaire, he would give out dimes to.
Oh God! I mean, that's like so. 'Tis the season, Scroogey.
Yeah. Then you find out, I think I read this last week, that there was a big fire in Bangladesh at this factory. That was making clothing for Walmart and a number of other, Disney and what have you. And at this meeting, the Walmart representative, they were saying that they had to have more safety and that these factories were just fire traps and all of this and that people were going to really get hurt. And they said they couldn't do it because it, quote, was a very extensive and costly modification. Now, one of the things that would normally happen if this was a normal capitalist interchange would be that the producer, say they're making, what's the name of that, I can't remember the name of their garments. You remember their jeans and stuff
like
that?
Oh, I have no idea, yeah. And I'm proud to say that.
Yeah, I guess I'm proud too. anyway, what would happen would be, The Bangladeshis hopefully would say, and the factory owners would say, yeah, you're right. We're gonna wind up having a catastrophic fire like that actually happened. I think, didn't it kill like, how many?
I don't remember.
140 or something like that? Or four? I hope it's 42. Let's say 42 because I don't want to, 112 workers. 112 workers. And they supply goods to Walmart and Sam's Club subsidiary. So what would happen? Say that, unlike it happened where industrial capitalism established itself all around the world, including the United States 150 years ago, that, the people were of good, good people and mm-hmm. rather trying to maximize profit understood that they owed something to the people that were working for them, didn't want to destroy their lives.
Well, that's gone.
Yeah, yeah. So, they would say, okay, we're going to put in, all these new improvements and safety features so these workers don't get burned up. And they would say, well, this is cutting into our profit. So what we're going to have to do, we're going to have to charge Walmart a little more.
Yeah.
Except it's the other way around. Walmart says, here's what we're paying per unit.
Right.
Period. And if you don't like it, we'll find somebody that'll produce for it.
And they're making everything so cheap
yeah.
that people shop there.
Yeah. So this is, capitalist blackmail. Walmart also wanted to build in Mexico, in this town
by
San Juan.
By the ruins, wasn't it? There was one by Tulum.
Am I saying that right? San Juan, Tikhonocan, Mexico. It was barely a mile from these ancient pyramids and was going to draw tourists from around the world. Walmart calculated it would attract 250 customers an hour if it could only put a store in Mrs. Pineda's field. This is in her alfalfa field. But one major obstacle stood in Walmart's way. After years of study, the town's elected leaders had just approved a new zoning map. The leaders wanted to limit growth near the pyramids, and they considered the town's main entrance too congested already. As a result, the 2003 zoning map prohibited commercial development in this field, dooming Walmart's hopes. So they probably just said, oh, shucks, and went back to wherever the hell they're from in Arkansas.
I mean,
they didn't. They came up with a $52,000 bribe to who did they give it to here? The plan was simple. The zoning map wouldn't become law until it was published in a government newspaper. So Walmart de Mexico arranged to bribe an official to change the map before it was sent to the newspaper record.
Corrupt.
To the newspaper records and interview shows. Sure enough, when the map was published, the zoning for Mrs. Pineda's field was redrawn to allow Walmart's store. Problem solved.
Corrupt to the core.
Yeah, corrupt to the core. Well, I'm going to say happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays to everybody.
Whatever you're celebrating.
And to John, our producer, thank you.
Calvin is not here.
Right.
Yeah. And
absolutely.
Certainly.
Greater Media.
Greater Media, our company.
Our bosses.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm totally like, why am I? And Jeremy, who puts up our podcast.
Yes.
Every single week, Monday at 12 o'clock, usually. So you can look for it then. Well, stay tuned for a couple of interesting interviews. And is Lynn in tonight? Is she going to be?
I believe it is Lynn.
Okay.
And by the way, that podcast will be up tomorrow. I already checked to make sure he was in tomorrow. So
okay.
I'll
so
get
that's
it
good.
Up. Yeah.
All right. So, hey, we'll see you next week. Probably. You know what? We're not 100% sure we're going to broadcast.
Right.
So do this. Keep checking my website.
And
I'm old. I'm 20th century. So Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Always good stuff. A lot of stuff
yes.
gets transferred by Debbie and by Jalene mm-hmm. to our Facebook page. which is Facebook/Night Call.
And happy holidays to Debbie.
To Debbie. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Everybody. Have we thanked everybody?
I think we have.
You know who we really
owe? Except for God, but we're atheists, so that's not going to work.
You know who we really got to thank?
Who?
All these people that are listening.
Absolutely. You guys are the reason for the season.
For the season. All right. Talk soon.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Out the corner of my eye, I saw a pretty little thing approaching me. She said, I never seen a man who looks so all alone. Could you use a little company? But if you pay the right price, your evening will be nice and you can go and send me on my way. I said, you're such a sweet young thing, why you do this to yourself? She looked at me and this is what she said. Oh, there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. I got try to make a move, I won't think twice. I told him you could have my cash, but first you know I gotta ask, what made you wanna live this kind of life? He said that.
Introduce you to the fine men who risk their lives and livers to make this possible.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Riff. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, gee, it's getting towards the end of the year. We are recording this particular segment of the Peter Werby Show on the day the world was supposed to end. Well, it hasn't. The people who least thought it was going to end were the Mayan people. They knew this was nuts, and it was just the end of a cycle. But there's another cycle ending here, and it has to do with the so-called fiscal cliff, and I think most of you are aware of that. And there's all this talk about our taxes going up. There's this deal that's going to be made between President Obama and the House Republicans, led by Representative John Boehner. And it's not all clear what is ahead. One thing that is we thought was clear is that President Obama and the Democrats were going to defend the basic safety net programs that have been in place for so long, particularly Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And suddenly it looks like maybe it is, as it's called, on the table. In fact, some people have said everything's on the table. Well, let's talk about a number of these aspects, but focusing on Social Security, because everyone, either, you know, depending on how old you are, either you're getting it or grandma and grandpa get it or your parents get it. And what's it going to look like? Say you're only 18 or 38 or 48. What's it going to look like when it's time for you to retire? Joining me is Nicole Wu. She's Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. She's worked on domestic hunger policy as the Associate Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and as a Senior Policy Analyst at the Food Research and Action Center. We're reaching her at her office in Washington, D.C. Nicole Wu, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
No, thank you, Peter.
Well, as we record this today, Friday, the vaunted Plan B from Representative Boehner has crashed. So it's not clear what is going on. Now, is this connected to Social Security? I mean, what role does Social Security play in the United States debt and deficit?
Oh, well, you've just asked about three questions all at once.
I did. Sorry.
But for your last one, Social Security actually has no effect on the deficit because by law, the program cannot pay out more than it takes in payroll taxes and interest. So it is puzzling that it was thrown into the mix at all at this point. As we all know, there's this thing called the fiscal cliff coming up, which I like to say is not a cliff. It's a really bad image. People think that when you fall off a cliff, you're going to crash and you're never going to be able to get out and it's over. And that's not what's happening here at all. At the end of the year, there's a set of tax increases and spending cuts that have been put into place. These triggers were put into place by a number of different agreements over the last 2 years on budgets. And they're going to all take place starting in January. But the kind of doomsday predictions of higher unemployment and our economy running into a recession next year are based on the analysis that nothing would be done to avoid some of these tax increases and spending cuts for all of 2013. You know, these predictions would assume that this nothing would be done, you know, into the fall or the end of the year next year. And I don't think any economists or politicians are actually talking about that. We can go into January or February, you know, tax increases and spending cuts are, you know, spread out over the course of a year. So there will be some effect in January. If they come to a deal in mid-January, even the end of January, they could put back any of the things that had happened. For example, they could say, hey, we want to put the middle income, the middle class tax cuts back. We're going to refund it to you in your next paycheck. So, you know, the first thing is that we have these deadlines at the end of the year that are creating panic. And I think we all know that you can't really make good decisions when you're in a panic. Washington's showing that right now. And in the last few weeks, they've thrown Social Security in, although Social Security and Medicare are not a part of the fiscal so-called cliff at all. They're not affected by anything happening at the end of the year. They're not going to change. But for some reason, actually both sides of the aisle seem to throw it back in.
Well, Nicole Wu, you mentioned panic, and here we are, like this is supposed to be the day when we're recording the end of the world and the fiscal cliff. There's a lot of anxiety, and so much of this is so complicated. People, I'm sure, that aren't experts, and even people that are experts have disagreements about where cuts should come, if cuts should come at all, whether taxes should be raised. But I want to go back to how Social Security is being on the table. I was just seeing today that Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, he said that President Obama is going back on repeated assurances that Social Security would not be part of deficit reduction talks. What's going on here?
That is true. I think we might remember during the presidential campaign, Senator Biden said very strongly, you know, we are not touching Social Security, period. He made a very strong statement, and President Obama never contradicted him. So, you know, we could assume that Biden was speaking for the campaign. You know, during the election this fall, President Obama ran on raising tax rates for the top 2%. And they also promised not to touch Social Security. As I said earlier, Social Security really doesn't officially contribute to the deficit at all because by law, if nothing is done to Social Security, in about 20-something years, the trust fund will start to be spent down because the trust fund has been built up since 1983. Workers have been putting in more money than has been going out. There's now over $2 trillion with a T dollars in that trust fund. So they're going to be spending that down because the baby boomers are retiring. when that trust fund is done in about 20-something years, the estimates kind of change a little bit every year. At that point, Social Security will be able to pay out about 75-80% of the promised benefits.
If nothing changes.
If nothing changes,
yeah, right.
If Congress does nothing.
Right.
And, you know, nobody wants, you know, a 20-25% drop in benefits. But that also doesn't mean that Social Security just ends. And I do think that a lot of the fear-mongering in the media makes people think that Social Security just won't be there, that people will go down to zero. And there is no analysis, there's no report, and I don't think there's any expert who would ever say that Social Security will completely run out and stop paying out benefits. At most, it'll go down to 75%. And on the flip side, there are a lot of ways to take care of this problem. For decades, you know, up through the 80s, almost every decade, little changes were made to Social Security to keep it solvent. In 1983, they actually were facing, you know, almost the end of Social Security. They put a few changes in. One was raising the retirement age from 65 to 67, very gradually. So right now, people can get their full retirement benefits at 66, and that's scheduled to go up slowly to 67. So there's already an increase in the retirement age there, and that's a benefit cut because that means people have to work longer to get their benefits and that their years of retirement are shorter. And there's also a thing called early retirement where people can take reduced Social Security benefits. They can take that at 62, but the further they get away from that full retirement age, 66 now or 67 later, the discount that they, yeah. You know, the amount that they give up to retire early, they have to, like, take a lesser amount. That, the amount that they lose gets bigger because they're further away from the full retirement age. So it is a benefit cut that they're already facing. You could help fix Social Security in a big way by increasing the amount of income that's subject to the payroll tax. I think most Americans make under $110,000 a year, so yep. They're not aware that the payroll tax that, you know, is applied for Social Security and Medicare, or the Social Security payroll tax, only taxes the first, right now, $110,000 a year, and
so,
that's scheduled to go up with inflation to $113,000 next year.
And if you're making, like, Timothy Cook, the CEO of Microsoft, who makes $375 million, he made that last year, he pays
right.
on $110,000. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Nicole Wu. She's Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. The website, and a lot of this information, in fact, all of this information and more is on this very important website. It's cepr.net, cepr.net. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and I will have a link to that as well. Now, one of the arguments, I've often said that, in fact, advocated that they ought to just take the cap off of the so-called FICA tax so that if you make $375 million a year, you pay the payroll tax on all of that. The argument is that that $110,000, I think this is hard to formulate, $110,000 represents putting that in, the tax on that every working year turns out to be the maximum you can get back from it. So if you paid on, say, $20 million a year, you'd be paying it almost has the Social Security system become a welfare system, because wealthy people then are paying, rather than people paying for themselves, wealthier people are paying for people below them, which it may be, but I have to say I don't care. But do you ever address that argument?
Well, Social Security already is structured in a kind of progressive way so that people with lower incomes get proportionally more back in Social Security. And I think most of us probably think that that's fair. If you weren't making a whole lot during your working years, you probably couldn't save too much. You probably didn't have access to a good employer pension, or you were much less likely. So, you know, we know that lower middle and lower income people rely much more on Social Security than the wealthy. So it's already set. It's basically a formula. They look at your lifetime average earnings, and the first about $10,000 in earnings, you get, you know, a pretty high percentage back. And then the next, you know, $100,000, you get a lower percent back. And then the top amount, it's only about a 5% return. So it's already been structured in the way that the richer you are, the proportionally lower amount you get. I mean, the dollar amount is probably higher for wealthier people because they did put more in, but proportionally compared to what they made, it is a lower amount. And they could do that as well. If they removed this cap for the Social Security taxes, or if they just raised it, you know, they could put another little bracket at the top to make sure that wealthy people don't get, like, out-of-control benefits, but also help support the whole program. One historical point is that back in 1983, when they set this cap, they set it to rise with inflation. And at the time, it was set to capture about 90% of the income in the country. And the problem that has happened, one of the big problems, is that since 1983, we've become more unequal. The rich have gotten richer, and the, you know, poorer people have gotten poorer. And so even though this cap rises with inflation, it's been capturing less and less income because so much more money is ending up above the cap. So now the cap is capturing about 85% rather than 90%. So there's a bunch of money there that just hasn't been captured for the last several years. That's added to the, you know, the future problems with Social Security. But if we were to raise the cap or eliminate it, a majority of the problem would just go away.
Sure.
And it would be fairer. You know, if you're making $1 million now, you're paying, you know, 10%, your rate, the rate that you're paying for Social Security is only 10% of what a regular person is paying. And that doesn't seem to make sense, that the wealthier should be paying a lower rate for Social Security taxes than your average working American.
In Europe, people retire at an earlier age, and here we are in the wealthiest country in the world. I don't know why people don't question more why cities are going bankrupt and there's so much poverty and what have you, I mean, which is maybe another question. But I would certainly think that that maybe taking some radical stances, like saying rather than raising the age of retirement, lower it. For one thing, that would create more jobs. I mean, if you had more people, say, retiring at the age of 60, I doubt if that has any political legs right now. But I wonder if we could start setting in motion the idea that, hey, the last – people are starting to live now into their 80s and 90s. Wouldn't that be nice to have the last third of your life just, you know, you're existing on the money that you put into it while you were working for the first 40 years? I'd be for that.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a generation of young people who have much higher unemployment rates than, you know, their predecessors. And a lot of these are college kids who are working, you know, kids with college degrees who are working at a Starbucks or something like that. And, you know, one way to help them out would be for, you know, people in their 60s to start retiring and literally make space in the workforce for the younger people. So, you know, we do have a problem on the lower end of the younger end of the workforce where they're just having trouble finding jobs. So it would help them as well. Another thing that my office has done is that we've done a paper where we looked at the types of jobs that older workers hold, the 58 to 65-year-olds. And we find that millions of them actually have jobs that have physical demands, physical difficulties. Either they're, you know, actually having to, like, lift luggage into airplanes, or they're working construction jobs, or they're just in jobs where there's no air conditioning, it's loud, you know, like in a factory. And, you know, millions of them. And if you break it down by income level or ethnic group, it changes. You know, the majority of older Latino workers are in physically demanding jobs. Same thing with lower income workers. And I think that's a really important point, because here in the Beltway in D.C., we have all these, like, 80-year-old people who are senators, or they work at a think tank, or they're professors, and they want to work until the day they die. And, you know, fine for them, good
sure.
for them. You know, they sit in an air-conditioned, cushy office. But that's not the majority of the American public. I think a lot of Americans in these hard jobs have bodies that just break down by the time they're 62, and they really don't have a choice but to retire earlier. And so that's something we try to mention when people talk about, you know, making changes to Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
We point out that people really need it, that they can't hold on to 68, 69 in a lot of the jobs that people have, and that, you know, changing the benefit structure really hurts the people who need Social Security the most.
Yeah, and it's just kind of heartless making people whose bodies can't deal with this, work that long. Nicole, well, before you were director of domestic policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, you worked a lot on domestic hunger policy at a number of groups. How do people do on Social Security? I mean, I know some people, they're getting like $700 a month. I don't, and somehow there's people in our country that think that it's an entitlement. Like somehow, I mean, that word has taken on a pejorative, you know, I deserve that. But what's the status of, and what did you see when you worked in hunger action groups in terms of older people?
You know, the Social Security program is the most successful program that our government has come up with, because it has kept a lot of older people out of poverty. Before Social Security, the elderly were the poorest section of our population. Poverty rates were very high. And now poverty rates for the elderly are lower, but still the average Social Security benefit is less than $15,000 a year. We find that 4 out of 10 or 2 out of 5 retirees on Social Security rely on Social Security for more than 90% of their income. So it's really important to keep people from going hungry. On the other side, though, you know, one of the things that we're hearing about throwing Social Security on the table in these fiscal cliff or just budget deficit discussions is that, you know, about a week or two ago, President Obama came out saying that he would agree to changing the cost of living adjustment for Social Security. That's how they were thinking about touching it and cutting it. Basically, they're saying that the inflation rate that Social Security uses to adjust benefits up every year isn't accurate enough, and it's actually been too high, and that there's another inflation measure that they want to use that's a little bit lower. And I think, you know, if you talk to most older people on Social Security, they're not going to say that their increases every year have been too high. They're going to tell you the absolute opposite. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics that keeps this data actually has an experimental index that just looks at the kind of cost that elderly people have. You know, elderly people spend more on their health care, for example, and they're not as mobile. They can't go around and comparison shop as much. And the experimental index that looks just at elderly costs or looks at how the elderly spend actually finds that their costs have been rising faster than the official rate. So, you know, the fact that the Democrats and Republicans are talking about lowering the inflation rate for Social Security so that the benefits adjust, they go up more slowly, is actually the opposite. And it would literally put more seniors into poverty and make more of them hungry. When I was working in the field on hunger, you know, we did see plenty of elderly people who were coming to the soup kitchens and, well, mostly the food pantries, needing food, especially at the end of the month when they're running out of benefits. You know, there are luckily some programs like Meals on Wheels that do help the elderly, but those are all facing cuts. Sure. You know, in the last few years, Congress and the President have already agreed to $1.5 trillion with a T dollars in spending cuts over the next 10 years. And programs like Meals on Wheels are the ones that have been getting hurt already. So it's just just an unfortunate time to see, sure, that in this economy we're cutting programs that people really need, and we're thinking about cutting them further.
I mentioned earlier, and I guess what I've always been driven by, and I know that your organization, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, I mean, it sounds kind of stiff and formal, but it has a heavy ethical component, and that's what you're talking about. I was just reading on an article in the New York Times that I have up here, and it's talking about currently, derivatives, remember those great little babies, are a $600 trillion market. And we're talking about cutting $15 out of grandma's Social Security a month. I mean, there is something ethically really amiss here. And I guess I do hear from you and from organizations like yours a heavy ethical component, where on the other side it's just all numbers. If we, you know, we get billions here and billions there, and we'll cut there and 100, you know, like that. And the people that are the most impacted by it are don't have a human face. You think that's true?
Oh, I think it is true. We do think about the people who are affected by it. But, you know, we do have a number of PhD economists who have very good reputations. They get their stuff in peer-reviewed journals all the time. And so we do look at the numbers. And we actually try to present the numbers in the most fact-based and unbiased way. And generally, you know, the fairness and ethical issues come out when you look at the numbers, because you see how different people are affected. You see how different income levels are affected, different age groups, different people of different ethnic backgrounds, and also different genders. So we just try to break through the headline numbers and
sure.
sort of show the actual effects of different on different people when these big ideas are getting tossed around.
Well, I suspect, and we're almost to the end of our conversation with Nicole Wu from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and you certainly, I hope it didn't sound like I was being at all critical of either your staff your name. that's fine. That's fine. People do wonderful work, and I've interviewed your associates many times before, and it's very important to get this information out. The individual that's sitting there that's probably just thinking, well, yeah, she just named off the people that are going to get screwed the worst, and I'm in there. Anything in the world they can do?
Well, they can tell their Congress people and even the president. You know, there's the whitehouse.gov has, I think, a place where you can make comments. But especially congressmen and senators, and let them know, you know, that, for example, you don't want any cuts to Social Security because it's not. It doesn't belong in the deficit discussions. It doesn't contribute to the deficit, and you can talk about how much people need it, especially if you have family members who rely on Social Security. Another thing about this change in the inflation rate that I want to mention
sure.
is that if the government were to change the inflation rate that's used to determine Social Security benefits, they're talking about applying it across the board because it is the official government rate. And that would affect all the different programs that are adjusted according to inflation. That's veterans benefits, disabled benefits, you know, food stamps, school lunch. Those are all based on, you know, those two are based on the federal poverty line that gets adjusted up for inflation. And on the flip side, our tax brackets are also affected by this inflation rate because tax brackets every year go up according to inflation. If they were to change it to a lower rate, the tax brackets would rise more slowly, which would mean that our incomes would jump up to higher tax brackets faster, which means an income tax increase across the board for everyone. The Joint Committee on Taxation has found that the majority of the increased income tax would come from people making under $100,000 a year. So again, it would change this inflation rate. They call it the chain CPI. It's a very technical term. But changing to the chain CPI would actually hit people both on the benefit side and also on the income tax side.
Well, it here is an instance where people, I think, at this sort of critical point where representatives are actually receptive to hearing from me. I know there's a lot of petitions online. Here in the Detroit area, there's a number of Democratic representatives and our two senators that probably need a lot of bolstering, particularly if President Obama is considering any cuts in Social Security. So, you know, it's your pocketbook, folks. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. My guest has been Nicole Wu. She's Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The website that has all this information, and a lot of this is tough to assemble in the brain, and this is maybe an introduction. You can leisurely look at it at cepr.net. Also, my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Nicole Wu, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Until my heart explodes, I highly doubt but I can make it through another other episode. Lashing out, one of the better moves your bubble for your lose control. You and me.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. It's a sad fact of life that the United States is a very violent country. It always has been. Its origins, its culture, and what have you. A lot of it, people celebrate the kind of military prowess we have. But what we don't like is violence in our daily life. And I think most people know that that women, as a gender, are at risk, no matter where they are, no matter what their color, class, geographical location. I've rarely spoken to a woman that by herself, no matter where she is, feels 100% safe and comfortable. I mean, that's a horrible indictment of our culture. It may be, even worse for African American women. I want to talk about that today. Bethy Ritchie is a professor of African American Studies in Criminology, Law, and Justice. She's at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's also the director of the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy. She's written Compelled to Crime, The Gender Entrapment of Battered Black Women. Her brand new book from New York University Press is Arrested Justice, Black Women, Violence, and America's Prison Nation. It's a pleasure to welcome Beth Ritchie to the Peter Werby Show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Peter, for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, I increasingly wonder how much, I mean, I understand both are at work here. How much are we talking about race and how much are we talking about class? Because it appears from what you've written and your concerns that black women are even more at risk from violence than white women. Yet a lot of this has to do, is centered among people in poverty. So what's the tension or the relationship between race and class here when it has to do with women and violence?
Good question, because race and class are often conflated, aren't they, right? When we talk about black, what comes to our mind is poor.
Yeah.
And when we talk about poor, listeners probably have a black person in their, you know, in their imaginary. And certainly there is some evidence that those two things coexist. In certain communities. But the point of this book really is to look at those black women in disadvantaged communities, poor black women, and their experience of violence as a way to kind of shine the light on other dynamics in the black community and other dynamics affecting women regardless of their race or ethnicity. So that's the starting point,
mm-hmm.
but I think there's some generalizable conclusions about male violence against women, and about poverty.
Well, should we consider race in this? If it is, because all over the world, violence is much higher among the poor, no matter what.
That's right.
What continent, whatever. It's a way of, I mean, the cultural message that all poor people get is scrambled up into then, violence among themselves very frequently. So, is race a factor here? Should it be considered?
Well, it should be considered, and I think it's important to kind of take a little nuanced look at this. It's not the case that poor people are more violent, but violence in more wealthy communities, in more privileged settings, can be hidden more. People who are victims of violence get more services. There's opportunities to intervene in violence with people who have more privilege than people who are poor. So it's important to note that the difference is the exposure to violence that poverty brings and the lack of intervention in poor communities that's really at issue here, not so much certain groups being more violent than others.
What's at root in terms of the violence towards black women? During the last election, when Barack Obama was reelected, there was all this talk about angry black men. And some of us said, gee, we wished he was. Is there more anger among black poor men than there are among white poor men?
Well, there would certainly be good reason for it if there were, wouldn't there, given the social conditions that black men often find themselves in. But the point that I'm making in Arrested Justice is more that black communities are experiencing violence from multiple sources, and black women experience a particular additional kind of violence, and that is gender violence. So I'm really trying to describe a set of circumstances in black communities, particularly in urban areas, in cities like Detroit and in Chicago, all around the country, where poverty, divestment from social services, failing education systems, lack of health care, closing mental health centers, those kinds of things that affect all members of a community have a particular salience, do particular harm to black women who experience male violence in addition to those other structural harms or structural abuses. And again, the point is not so much that black men are more violent toward black women because they're angry, but more that the conditions in black communities are ripe, if you will, for the use of violence and the non-intervention from social services in response to the violence.
Mm-hmm. Beth Ritchie, you, in your book, so far our discussion, if it was called Black Women and Violence, all of our conversation would have been completely understandable. But as you just said, the main title is Arrested Justice, Black Women, Violence, and America's Prison Nation. So where does Arrested Justice and America's Prison Nation fit into the violence against black women?
So the prison nation is a term that many activists and scholars are using. Some people call it the prison industrial complex. Some people call it the carceral state. It's a set of both real and metaphorical prisons, if you will. So it's the building of jails and prisons and detention centers and locking people up in them, accompanied by public policies that basically criminalize people for the social problems that they are experiencing. So the prison nation is what happens when we close mental health clinics and we arrest people who are displaying their mental illness on a sidewalk, right? And instead of taking them to the clinic, we take them to the jail. Or when kids are acting out in school for any number of reasons, instead of, you know, trying to channel them back into their, you know, educational objectives, we not only force them out of school, but then we arrest them because they're truant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we have chosen to deal with all kinds of failing public systems by applying a law or using law enforcement responses. Hence, we have this mass incarceration, particularly of poor people of color, into jails and prisons, which are big industry in this country. So that's the prison nation piece. Ironically, over time, Peter, we've worked hard to develop an intervention system on the issue of violence, right? And so we have rape crisis centers and domestic violence programs and prevention programs in schools, and those help some women who experience violence, more privileged women. During the era of a prison nation, those women who are most disadvantaged, instead of being directed towards services, get caught up in that same prison nation and end up in jails and prisons themselves as victims of a crime, as opposed to getting the kinds of services that they need to support themselves toward a more safe living environment in their intimate communities.
Beth Ritchie, I know my audience well enough that some of them are thinking, well, here's another liberal just trying to trying to justify behavior that, that individually, you know, should be condemned and punished. And if and if people of color or women of color are committing a disproportionate number of crimes, well, then they belong in prison. That's the argument.
Yeah, you know, I've been called a lot worse than a liberal, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
work. I'll take that one.
All right.
Look, it's true that people need to take responsibility for their behavior. And, you know, I think that there's lots of room to grow for many of us, for all of us in that area. So I'm not arguing against individual responsibility. What I'm suggesting is that there are increasingly constraints put on people so that they can't take responsibility for the circumstances that they find themselves in. If you're poor, and so you're dependent on someone else's income, even if that income comes from illegal sources like selling drugs, and you're hurt by that person too, but you really don't have any place to go, and there's no services for either your physical pain or your psychological suffering, and part of the way that you're abused is coerced into illegal sex work or into using or selling drugs yourself, and therefore you're not able to take care of your kids. And then finally, that real awful abusive episode happens, and somebody calls the police, and the police come, and there you are. Maybe there's drug paraphernalia. Maybe there's kids who haven't been taken care of. Maybe there's someone in your public housing apartment who has a felony background, and he or she isn't supposed to be there. So you see how that's – and what happens? You get slapped with any number of charges, child endangerment, possession of illegal substances, harboring, you know, someone in your, you lose your apartment because you had someone there who was a felon there, and you may end up homeless or you may not, but you may end up with a criminal background yourself. And all along that path, Peter, there were things we could have done differently. We could have said, wow, we should have had an intervention for the violence. We should have safe, affordable housing for people. Women need help taking care of their kids sometimes. Where's the child care services, right?
Yeah.
Any number of places along the way, we could have done something to enable someone to take better care of their of themselves and their circumstances. We don't do that, and then we charge people, right, for what they've done wrong.
That's the arrested justice.
That's the arrested justice.
Black women Violence and America's Prison Nation. My guest is Beth Ritchie. She's a professor of African American Studies in Criminology, Law, and Justice at the University of Chicago, University of Illinois at Chicago. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, there'll be a link to it. Also, you can go to the Facebook page for the book. Just look up Arrested Justice. Now, you have been, I mean, we're describing the problem, but yourself and others have addressed it as well. And tell us a little about the efforts that you've made over the last couple of decades to intervene in this, and you know, the organizing you were doing in Harlem, and also that it's not the understanding this is not just a black thing, but
right.
That there's a multiracial aspect to it that we all have a vested interest in. Tell us a little about that.
So there is, I think, a really important and actually very powerful anti-violence movement in this country. States like Michigan are at the forefront of it, and cities like Detroit have done incredible work setting up services for women. And by that, I mean there are hotlines to call, there are rape crisis centers to go to, college campuses have wonderful services for women who are hurt. University of Michigan was one of the first and is, in fact, still one of the best places in terms of college campus support services. So there's all kinds of opportunities now, both for providing services, but equally important for changing public consciousness about this problem. 30 years ago, when I was doing this work initially in Harlem, people were like, battered women? Who does that happen to?
Sure.
Rape? Well, she must have deserved it. Child sexual abuse? That doesn't happen here. So lots of progress has been made. And I want to be very careful not to diminish the important strides of it. You know, celebrities come out about their abuse now on national television, right? The
right.
White House has an Office of Violence Against Women set up in the Department of Justice. So lots of good work has happened.
Yeah, the response has certainly gotten better. The consciousness has certainly gotten better. But I wonder if there's actually a diminishing of violence against women. I mean, that's what's...
Well, there's a diminishing of violence against some women. And this is where race and class get invoked again, Peter. There are lots of women, probably hundreds of thousands of women, who are safer today because of the 30 years of activist work. And there's a real sort of story for those listeners who are interested in the progress of a social movement. It's been a relatively short period of time that we've seen tremendous change in understanding this problem, not just in this country, but in fact globally. That's the good news. With that progress, however, has come, I don't know how to say this, I want to call it a whitening of the issue, right? That innocent victims of male perpetrators kind of capture our attention. She didn't deserve it. Nothing can be used to justify sexual assault or sexual harassment. The big high-profile cases that we know about are typically innocent victims, and I'm sort of using that in, you listeners can't see me, but I'm doing those air quotes with my fingers, you know, innocent victims.
Yeah.
They've never done anything wrong, and they didn't deserve this. That's true. There's another segment of our communities who, over the last 30 years, have been living under what I call the prison nation, whose needs and experiences aren't understood very well, and the anti-violence intervention services haven't attended to very well. So I'm talking about gay or lesbian kids who are living on the street, who are homeless, who've been thrown out of their schools and their families, rejected by their faith institutions, who experience violence, rape, battering, sexual harassment, stalking. They don't call rape crisis centers for support. Rape crisis centers don't always know how to deal with that circumstance, right? They're
mm-hmm.
less innocent victims because they may have, I don't know, shoplifted a sandwich out of the corner 7-Eleven because they were hungry, right? We haven't found our ways into jails where women are housed and actively detoxing, and we ask them all sorts of things about their drug abuse, but we don't ask, did any of this have to do with the fact that you were being hurt at home, right? So there's a segment of our population that we have ignored, and when I say we, I'm talking the anti-violence movement as well as everybody else. Those are the people, those are the women who are suffering under the prison nation, and the two kind of populations don't reconcile, don't line up very nicely next to each other. That is the innocent victim and the women with more complicated life circumstances who have been criminalized in the same 30 years that the anti-violence movement has done its best work.
The book is Arrested Justice, Black Women, Violence, and America's Prison Nation. My guest is the author, Beth Ritchie, and there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, for all the information. You can go to the Facebook page for Arrested Justice. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. You probably might turn it around and ask me, what's up with men? You know, why after all of this? I mean, I remember years ago a feminist group saying most of the women, most of the world's problems would be solved if men did not touch anybody without permission. Which is an interesting way to put it. And the other thing is men say, she made me so angry.
Yeah.
You know, she did this or that. But there, and you may know this, this famous example, that you're standing waiting for a subway in New York and suddenly someone slams into you, turn around with your fist balled, you're so angry that this happened, and then you see it's a blind person, and then all of your anger dissipates. Or you see it's a guy that's 6'8". So, there's something deep in enough male psyches with all the consciousness, with all the response, that there's some men that still feel that there's some legitimacy for using violence on weaker people.
That's right. And now that's both a individual story and a family dynamic, but it's certainly part of our national story, isn't it? Right? That we can justify the use of violence by looking at other people's behaviors. We do that. That's why we wage war on people. That's why police can use violence to control a person who they feel like might be at risk. And that's why, in the context of an interpersonal relationship, the person with more power, who's usually the male, can use it to abuse a woman or children.
Mm-hmm.
That we do kind of use violence in that hierarchical way to, you know, take care of our business. It's our responsibility almost to use violence to control other people if they're not doing what we think they ought to be doing. Now, look, there's lots of good men who do really important work to change that culture. And again, I think the state of Michigan has some really exciting programs run by men, for men, with men in key leadership positions saying, come on, we're not going to stand up to that, right? We are going to stand up for that, excuse me. It's, in other words, that's not us. That sort of mythical man out there who uses violence to control people, come on, we're not all like that, and we're going to show you another way. So I think there's some important counterexamples to that larger narrative. But it is still the case. It is still the case that men who use violence toward women, especially if she's not an innocent victim, can get away with it. The cases that I talk about in the book of men who target prostitutes because they think somehow they're, you know, that prostitutes are doing something so so vile, so immoral, that they're not real women, they're hardly real people, and so they deserve the violence that they get. And the kind of serial targeting of prostitutes. There's a story in the book of a woman who lived in public housing and decided to kind of stay in public housing despite the fact that the city of Chicago had decided to tear down the buildings. So she dared sort of stand up against or not move when the city of Chicago said move. Undercover cops thought she's a perfect target for it. She deserved the violence that she got. She was resisting, you know, this public policy of dismantling public housing. And so the kinds of stories that I talk about in Arrested Justice are those where women somehow sort of upset men or threaten men or threaten official power in some way. And they're the real targets of abuse. They're the real targets of abuse. And the system doesn't protect them. The system just doesn't protect them.
You know, I always try to keep optimistic, but some of these these problems we've been facing forever never seem to be ameliorated. I mean, they continue onward, even though I think, probably most of these problems that we have are about like a third of the population. I mean, most men don't hit women and don't hit children.
Right.
You know, most, I hope we can say this, most white people, at least up here, aren't racist.
That's right.
All of that. And yet the persistence of it all really starts to drag me down sometimes,
yeah,
I have to say.
Yeah.
Probably,
well,
you know, and you, as a woman and a woman of color, it probably, does it wear on you worse than me?
Who knows, Peter? The one thing that I get that you might not is I get to be around strong, powerful women of color, black women, other women of color who say, you know, we can change this. We got this taken care of. Now, we've got a long way to go. No one's really listening to us yet, but we do understand that it's wrong, and we understand that there's power in organizing in our communities, and that it actually does give me hope. Let me shout out the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community in Minnesota. That's a national organization, men, women, older people, younger people who are saying, there's a wonderful part of being black in America today for lots of reasons, and we're going to use that as the definition of ourselves, and we're going to take that energy back into our communities, and we're going to say, stop arresting children, stop committing acts of violence. There's a whole stereotype about everybody's in a gang. Not everybody's in a gang. There's some really important, loving brotherhoods that exist that take care of other people. Our faith-based communities can do something. They don't always do the right thing, but they can do something. We're embracing our whole community. So I'm sort of going on and on about that to say there's lots of people doing good work, trying to resist that sort of combined harm that's caused by violence and the prison nation. And I think that's where the exciting opportunities for the future in black power, if you will, exist. And look, if we can't solve the problem of violence by turning people over to a violent state, that's the point of the book. Instead, what we have to do is say, keep your hands off our communities, prison industrial complex. Communities, keep your hands off each other. You know, let's try to find a better way. And, you know, some people are doing it. There's some really exciting small intervention programs, often led by young people, that are making a huge difference.
Well, that's great. The book is Arrested Justice, Black Women, Violence, and America's Prison Nation. Beth Ritchie has been my guest. Thank you so much for being on the broadcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Goodbye. I didn't tell her that I loved her, how much I care. To thank my pops for all the talks and all the wisdom he shared.
life.
More Riff Rock now. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Yeah.